Okay. Good morning. We're going to go ahead and get started, even if Steve don't want us to down here.
Hey, we're catching up.
My name is Jake Albrecht. I'm the chairman of the Utah Wildlife Board. I want to make some introductions, and I'll start on my left with Steve Dalton from Teasdale out of the southern region. We'll excuse Dr. Woodward this morning. And then we have Calvin Crandall from Springville out of the central region. And Bill Fenimore on my left, who's the vice chair from Farmington, northern region. On my right is Greg Sheehan, the division director and acting executive secretary. But he does not have a vote, unfortunately. And then John Baer is also absent today. I think he's in Canada on business. Don't know what kind of business. Then we have Mike King from Price, who represents the Southeast region. And then we also have Stacy Coons, who is the wildlife coordinator, and Tuvo Wood, who is the director's executive secretary, helping with the minutes and recording. And then the RAC chairman, we have Dave Black from the southern region, Kevin Albrecht from the Southeast region, Wayne McAllister from the Northeast region, Gary Nielsen from the Central region, and good old Robert from the Northern region. Robert Burns, welcome. Our first item of business this morning is to approve the agenda of October the 2nd, 2014. So we have a motion by Mr. Fenimore.
I'll second that.
A second by Calvin. All in favor, please. Motion carries unanimous. Second item on the agenda is approval of the minutes of August 28th of 2015. I went through those, and I couldn't find anything.
Mr. Chairman, I accept we move the, or accept we move we accept the minutes. Of the last meeting.
Okay, so we have a motion to approve the minutes of August 28th, seconded by Steve Dalton. All in favor? That also carries. Our next item is the action log. Mr. Fenimore.
Yes, we have several items that Shannon's going to update us on from the action log.
I don't have an agenda with me. Was there an order that you wanted them in? What was the first one? Okay, thank you.
Maybe while you give us the update, you might also give us kind of a recap of how's your committee doing on the mule deer plan.
We're done with the committee. We've met. We had our last meeting in middle of September. And it was good. We ended up having 9 meetings, pretty thorough discussion about the strategies and content of the deer plan, and I'm happy with it, yeah. Okay, my name's Justin Shannon. I'm the big game coordinator, and the first action log item is the multi-season deer permits. I think the title was, the real title was premium limited entry deer permits. And it gets really confusing because we have premium limited entry deer units, and so we've changed this a little bit. This motion was made in May 2012 by Calvin, and it was given by Calvin Crandall. It says, I move that we have placed on the action log that the division look into a premium limited entry deer tag similar to the premium limited entry elk tag. Some of the actions taken were this past summer we held a manager's meeting with the regions. And internally, there's support for this idea. We already do it for bear and elk, and we have a framework we can follow. It would be good on select limited entry and premium limited entry units, and 3% of the total permits would be allocated towards multi-season permits. Some units that may not be included are the Crawford Mountains and Dolores Triangle, just because of that either the weapon type that's used on those hunts or the limited number of permits. And I do want to point out, too, this can be implemented as soon as possible, but in the near future, a fee schedule change is going to be needed. Right now, we don't have a fee schedule that says that essentially puts a price on these permits, and so in the future, we will be bringing that forward. On August 26th, the Mule Deer Committee discussed this idea, and they supported it, and it is a strategy in the statewide plan that you'll see at our next board meeting. So in conclusion, multi-season permits will be presented to the Wildlife Board in December as part of the statewide plan, and we support this idea. So.
So on all of these items, we've addressed them in the Mule Deer Plan, and we'll have feedback. But if there are elements of these that Justin's going to cover today that you'd like us to also bring recommendations to that December board meeting, and meaning you want us to act on those for this coming season, this would be the time to give us that direction so we could be preparing that to come to you in December. So,
is this something that's going to go through the rack, or is it just going to the board?
It will be a strategy in the deer plan, which will go through all the racks.
So it'll go through it as part of the deer plan then?
Yes, okay. Yeah. Yeah, and then in the spring when we put permits to it, it'll go through again.
And it'll go through again. You'll start assigning some permits and some numbers to it.
Correct. Yeah.
So in other words, you know, if the deer committee adopted this, it will be in the plan. But if you see it in December and say, looks like they like it, if you don't take some action then, there's a year before you can really talk about it again. So if you like multi-year deer, give us some guidance now, and we can bring something to you in that December meeting. Otherwise, you got to wait a year to do anything.
Well, and that was my question, Justin, is do you plan on bringing it through the November rack then, or October rack?
You know, right now I haven't done that because I wanted to get it approved in the deer plan first. And right now, if we took it through, the cost of one of these multi-season permits would be the same as a normal limited entry or premium limited entry on the Henrys and Ponsagant. And so we need to take it through the fee schedule to increase that, because the value of that permit is much greater than the normal cost of a limited entry or premium limited entry.
Right.
So that was the plan. But if you'd like, we can bring it through now and just charge those lower costs and then take that through the fee schedule next year. And if you want it implemented now, I can certainly bring it as a recommendation next month.
Well, I would hope that, I mean, this is a kind of a contingent item, but I would hope that we would bring that through this coming year. And is that the feedback I'm hearing from you guys?
Yes. Do you want that in the form of a motion, or?
Yeah, I think we could go ahead and do that. It's actually a, I don't know whether it's an action item or not by legality, but we've got to give him some direction, so let's go ahead and try one.
I make the motion that we implement that, the premium limited entry deer tag, so that, I guess the description is so they can hunt all three seasons.
Correct.
For buck deer.
So as part of your motion, I think on Steve's part would be to go ahead and implement it and run it through the rack process. We're not giving it the final approval today. So you'll bring it through with your plan.
When we follow through and set numbers in the springtime so that next, you know, deer hunt of 2015, it would be implemented and up and running.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to take another year before that happens, correct?
Right. And I'm very comfortable bringing it.
Okay. I got to say, I would second Steve's motion then.
All right. So we have a second by Calvin. Mike?
I just have a question. What it's been a while since we talked about this. Tell me again what the rationale behind the bringing it forward is.
Yeah, so essentially what it is it's just increasing, it's given a more quality hunt on some of these units. We do it for elk. Right now, if a unit has 100 permits, we take three of those, and we allow them to hunt archery, muzzleloader, and the any weapon hunt as well. And the value of those permits are more, and it's its own hunt that people apply for, and the cost is a little bit higher, but they get a better experience. And so it's almost like the dedicated hunter program, but for limited entry and premium limited entry units. Kind of the same things apply.
And this is a draw application,
yeah.
So
yeah,
anybody has the opportunity to apply for it, but depends on points and luck and those kind of things.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So it's going to be just like the limited entry deer or the elk, same thing, same process, only we've never really had one for deer. This just implements this for deer.
Right. Yeah.
A premium.
Okay.
So we had a motion by Steve and a second by Calvin to go ahead and include this with the mule deer plan and bring it forth at the upcoming RAC meetings for this year. All in favor? Motion carries. Okay.
Yeah.
So in just in case it wasn't clear what Justin was talking about on the fees, next August we would bring out to the RACs a higher fee. So right now that premium fee, even though you could hunt three seasons, is going to be the same as the regular limited entry fee. So year or two from now, then we'll raise it to, instead of 150 or whatever, it'll be 300 or some number that we come up with. So
what's the difference on the elk, on your elk permits versus your limited entry elk? How much price difference is
on,
there
on cost?
On cost, yes,
it's about 1.8 higher. So and I have it in my data book that the elk permit essentially, or the value of the premium limited entry permit, is 1.8 times
1.8 times whatever the other it is. Okay.
Okay. Next on action item was management buck hunts on the Book Cliffs. Motion was made by Dale Brady in December of 2011. It says, I move that the division be asked to review the buck management tags on the Book Cliffs. People are always reporting the presence of big 2 and 3 point bucks in that area. Perhaps these permits could be given to youth. This is to be addressed during the revision of the deer management plan in 2014. Some actions taken. During summer of 2013, so last year, the Northeast region and the Southeast region put a committee together to discuss discrepancies in buck-to-doe ratios on the north and south portions of the Book Cliffs units. What we were hearing from the hunters and what our own data was showing us was, on the north, you had lower buck-to-doe ratios. When you're managing that unit, it's 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does, and they were closer to the 25 end. But then on the south end of that unit, we were 35 to 40 bucks per 100 does, so the quality there was quite different. But because it was all one unit, the Northeast region biologists were saying we need to cut permits, and Southeast region saying we need to increase permits. And it was a very real thing. Quality was declining on that unit. And so we put together a committee of hunters to address this issue. And there was consensus from this committee to simply split the north and the south during the any weapon hunt. And this was passed by the board last December, and we will implement it for the first time here later this month. This issue was also taken to the Mule Deer Committee, and the committee voted unanimously in August to not recommend a management buck hunt on the Book Cliffs. Some of the reasons that were given was they didn't want to take a limited entry permit out of the hands of hunters and give them a lesser hunt. We talked about some of the law enforcement challenges that come with antler point restrictions. Right now, management hunts are used to lower buck-to-doe ratios on units that have an age objective. So like the Henrys and the Ponsagant, we're managing those populations to have 40 to 55% of the bucks be 5 years or older. And if we have a higher buck-to-doe ratio, we use management tags to lower that. And on the Book Cliffs and some of these other units where we're not managing to an age objective, it was, why would you do it? How would you do it? Just give them a normal permit. And then the last point kind of followed the idea that a trophy buck and a management buck is really in the eye of the beholder. Some of these deer that may be considered not as great, if you're an archery hunter and you get close to that, that may be a great deer. And so it was somewhat subjective as to what people were willing to harvest and weren't. And So in conclusion, the division does not recommend a management buck hunt on the Buck Cliffs because of the actions taken to split the unit. We feel that by doing that and being able to put the right amount of permits on the north and south portions, we can increase quality on that northern end where we were seeing declines and hearing complaints from the public, and also based on the feedback from the Mule Deer Committee.
So, Justin, is that last paragraph here, is that the consensus from that region then?
From the northeast region? Yeah. When we met a year ago to discuss the decrease in quality, we wanted to try splitting that unit first and see what kind of response we got that way, because what it would allow you to do is to get a higher buck-to-doe ratio and manage that a little tighter, and so you can increase the quality and go that route.
I wanted to make sure that that was what they thought, not what the committee thought.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the division's perspective. Yeah, the committee voted not to recommend it as well.
So you've split the permits, to split the unit. You've got a north and a south, and you're going to try that first to see what happens?
Yeah.
So is Mr. Brady okay with that? What do you think?
I don't know if he would be or wouldn't be. I'm not.
He's sure. Going to call me, so you got to tell me what I think.
I don't. The next action log item, let me get that pulled up, is muzzleloader pronghorn. Additional muzzleloader pronghorn hunting opportunities. This motion was made by Ernie Perkins in December of 2012. It says, I move that we ask the division to study additional muzzleloader pronghorn opportunity as presented in the November RAC by Mr. Zundel. This is to be placed on the action log item. So to give you some background on pronghorn, we have 28 units that we manage for any weapon. We allow any weapon hunting on, and success rates are about 94%. We have 21 units that we allow archery hunting on, and success rates are about 60. And then we have one unit that we have muzzleloader hunting on, and that's the Plateau, and success rates are about 52. And I looked at those data and I thought, how are the muzzleloader success rates lower than the archery? And so I teased out the Plateau as a standalone because that's the only one we have to compare it to. And if you look at that, any weapon's 88%, muzzleloader's 52%, and archery is 34% success rates. And so in last year we issued 781 buck pronghorn permits across these 28 units that we have. And the idea in showing those success rates is that we look at this and we believe that there's more pronghorn opportunities can be achieved if we create more muzzleloader hunting units. So some of the actions taken, we discussed this last year internally with the regions, and the division met, we met to discuss it, I guess. I shouldn't read and talk at the same time. Three units that we looked at really floated to the top. They had an average of 97 any weapon permits, and that was the Plateau, where we already have muzzleloader hunting, the Cache Morgan, Southridge Ogden, and the Southwest Desert. And then if you combine the remaining units, they averaged about 12 any weapon permits. And again, that's an average. We have some that are in the 20s. But as we looked at this, we really had three units that just looked like they had a lot of permits, and then some, the rest were in this lower tier. And what we've looked at is creating more muzzleloader hunting opportunities on those units, and it can do a couple things. It can reduce hunter crowding during the any weapon hunts, and it can provide more opportunity with a lower success rate and get guys through the muzzleloader point system quicker. If we did this, we'd follow what we do on the Plateau with the breakdown in permits of 20% archery, 20% muzzleloader, and 60% rifle. So in conclusion, at the next RAC and Wildlife Board meeting, we plan on proposing a muzzleloader hunt on the Cache Morgan, Southridge Ogden, and the Southwest Desert units. And I'm really interested to get the feedback from those to see if hunters are liking this and if this is something we should explore further. So that's my report.
Okay, so any discussion on the Plateau about separating the highway that goes to Loa? I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the north end, which is part of what I call the North Mountain, Buffalo. We talked before about having like a muzzleloader seizing on the north side and then regular hunting on the plateau on the south side of the highway. Was there any discussion about that at all?
No, I didn't know that was an issue or a conversation point.
Probably wasn't. We've just talked about it in meetings and RAC meetings before. I was wondering if it ever brought back up again.
Not with this action. I can talk to the southern region and see if that's something they want to explore. I know they did some boundary changes around Johns Canyon and some of that stuff last year in December. I can certainly talk to him about it.
Brought back during the RAC, during some of the other people.
Okay.
Any questions on this? Okay, the conclusion, you're going to bring it back to the RAC this fall?
Yeah, it'll be in the December board. We're going to try it on some more units. I think it's a good idea. So,
I do too.
Unless you don't want to, you know, this is an action item. If your action is tell us don't do it, we won't. But certainly it's something we could come propose.
I'd move forward with it.
I think what you may see is it'll probably increase permit numbers some based on those success rates. But that distribution of permits, the 20-20-60, which is what we're doing on deer and other things in the state, it could, even though we add more permits, could lower the rifle permits potentially a little bit. Is that accurate, Justin?
Yeah, it would certainly do that, yeah.
So if you don't want those ratios, that's a different discussion, but certainly we could put some more permits out there. So
we'll see what the public feels the way I look at it.
Okay. Okay, the next action log item is mountain goat season date extensions. Motion was given by John Baer, December of 2013. I move that we add Ben Lauder's request to extend the goat hunt season to the action log and have the division evaluate the hunt structure and report on their findings at the same time next year. Again, this summer, the regions, we met with them to discuss mountain goat season dates. And we just had some discussion points. Some are positive, some are negative, but I just wanted to present the issues that we discussed. The first one was safety of mountain goat hunters being in the field too late. Where mountain goats are oftentimes high elevation, precipitous slopes, you get snow conditions, ice conditions. We did have some good conversations about the safety of hunters as we move forward with this. Another talking point that we had, I guess, was Forest Service road closures. A lot of these occur in mid-November, some the end of November in many parts of the state, and it would prevent access points to get to these animals. And what we wanted to avoid was having hunts that went beyond where hunters could reasonably get to the mountain goats and their habitat anyways. And so that was a really good point that was brought up. And then the other thing that we'd have to navigate through is transplants. Generally right now on areas like Willard Peak, when we do mountain goat transplants, it's between October 12th when the mountain goat hunt season dates end to the beginning of the deer hunt because we have that window. And if we extend hunts, we may be transplanting animals potentially during hunts. And that's something we'd have to consider as well. But these are all things we can navigate. There's some really good things. Extending days in the field for a once-in-a-lifetime hunt, I view that as a good thing. As a hunter, if I had that permit, I understand why this action item came about. I would thoroughly enjoy that. And the idea of longer coats on mountain goats, that's true. The colder it gets, the later it gets, that hair is going to be better, and that would be a benefit to hunters if they were to harvest. So with all that discussion in mind, here again in December, what the division's planning on is recommending extended mountain goat season dates, in some cases up to the end of November where those Forest Service road closes, and on some units to allow hunters the opportunity to harvest animal with a longer coat. So this is something that we can get behind and certainly recommend. So
an example of some units.
Like the Nebo, I think there you can go pretty late in November. Maybe some of the Wasatch stuff, Tampa and some
but
of those
the ones were like where you're mainly overpopulated, like the Tushers and some of the others, you might not do that.
I think more of like the Uintas, you probably wouldn't do it because sometimes, I mean, even right now, these hunts go till October 12th, and the Northeast region doesn't advise their goat hunters to go up past the first week of October. Their weather conditions are interesting there. They get snow, it can stick, and it's some pretty intense wilderness area.
Well,
so.
Even looking at 2 weeks ago when the hunt opened on the Beaver, and then last weekend you got 8-10 inches of snow, what I hear, you know, your access really diminishes even at this time of year. So,
and that's the balancing act, is because I think we want to give hunters an extended opportunity. I just don't know if
that would be applicable
every year.
Decision, you know, whether they want to deal with the environment.
Justin, could you briefly tell us how the goats are doing on the LaSalle's that have been transferred there?
Yeah. They're doing well. We've had a little bit of mortality this first year. I wish I had these numbers off the top of my head. I think we've lost 3 or 4. I know one fell off a cliff. I guess it got into some loco weed or something and had a spill. We've had some that have just had unique behaviors, movements right off the beginning. They hung down in juniper and some of these lower elevations. But that first initial transplant, they're back up on the mountain now, which has been good. And then a month ago or so, we took 15 more off of the Tushers and took them to the LaSalle's as well. And the majority of them are staying up high. But again, these initial transplants, you got some that are just doing these exploratory movements, and we feel confident they'll figure it out. So
I had Dustin Mitchell come and talk to one of my classes on Monday, and he's the biologist that's down there now working that. And he said they also had 2 kids that were born this last spring.
While we're on this topic, it was one of my updates, but let's jump to it now. Last year when the board passed the motion in September, or end of August, I think where it was, one of the follow-ups was that the division would form a committee to make sure that the concerned citizens and others who, Forest Service others, had some input as we evaluated the range conditions up there. So we've formulated that committee, I think, and been working with the Forest Service and others throughout the summer. But you had a formal meeting 2 weeks or so ago with just make a quick update on that, if you would. Who was there and how that went?
On the Dutton, I think they had it, I'm trying to remember, middle of September, right around there, and good feedback. I mean, I think it's beneficial to go spend time with the stakeholders, and that was a good meeting on the Dutton, and then on the LaSalle's maybe a week and a half ago or so, there was one, and Like Greg was saying, sportsmen showed up, the Forest Service showed up, Farm Bureau, the groups down there like TNC and Grand Canyon Trust, some others, and it was good. We just had a good discussion about the management and the direction of these mountain goats. So,
okay. So, in conclusion, are you guys okay with moving this into the, is this something you'd think about bringing this fall then?
Yeah, if the board's comfortable.
You guys good here?
Sure.
Okay, let's do that then.
Okay, non-resident sheep. Okay, the next action log item is non-resident sheep permit quotas. This motion was made by Ernie Perkins in May of 2013. I move that we ask the division to prepare a sheet for the board and the Northern Region RAC that shows the sheep unit grouping and permit percentage rules that were passed by the board last year and subsequent total permits and breakout between once-in-a-lifetime conservation and convention permits for each sheep species in each unit group. I'll be honest, I struggled to understand what was really wanted with that, and I went back and listened to a bunch of the audio to try to wrap my mind around what was taking place in these meetings. I talked to Robert as well, and what it was a gentleman, a came to the RAC meeting a year and a half ago at the Northern Region and was struggling to understand how we allocate our bighorn sheep permits. And so what we're aiming for, what we're striving for, is a 90-10 split on residents versus non-residents. And if you look at the 2013 information, residents, non-residents, and percent of permits that went to non-residents, on the deserts, 14% of the tags went to non-resident hunters. And so I think that's where the concern was how come residents don't get their fair 90-10 split. And this last year, it kind of self-corrected. We actually under-allocated a little bit. On of the 40 permits, 3 went to non-residents, 37 went to residents. But at the bottom there, for on total, in 2013, 12% of our permits went to non-residents, and this last year, 9% did. And there's some reasons behind that. Part of it is just simply rounding. If you look at part of the motion was to look at the groupings. One thing we did is we took a couple units, 2 to 3, and we clumped them together, and that way we could get enough permits that might be closer to 10, to where we could say, okay, a non-resident can hunt all two or three of these units, and there's a permit for them. So the Santa Fe North and the Santa Fe South is one of those groupings, and this was a new thing we were doing, and I think it was hard to understand at first as to why and what the intent was. But if you look at the Caparowitz East, Escalante, and West, individually, if you looked at all those by themselves, Caparowitz East only has 3 permits, Escalante only has 2, and the West in 2013 only had 3. None of them would really qualify for a non-resident permit, but by grouping them, we can round that a little easier, get a non-resident a permit. The other groupings that we had were the LaSalle, Potash, South Cisco, the Lockhart in the South, the Henry Mountains and the Dirty Devil, and the Zion and the Pine Valley. And so by grouping them, we, again, can make those. Before I get to the conclusion, there's one more part here that says that they've asked the division to prepare a sheet for the board. I have that now, which I'd like to hand out and give one to Robert as well for the Northern Region. So in this sheet, this has more than the PowerPoint does, but it essentially talks about how they're grouped together and answers some of these other questions as well. So,
Justin, this is just a technicality, and it probably doesn't make any difference. It's probably just in response to the motion, and I didn't catch this at the time, but it says each sheep species. And we only have one species, right?
We have one species. Yeah, we have the subspecies.
So
I broke it down for deserts and Rockies. Yeah.
It probably doesn't make any difference. But.
So anyways, again, this is just to try to give the information as to what we're trying to accomplish. And again, what we're really striving for is to round a 90-10 split. And as we have units that have very few permits, sometimes that can get difficult. And so the grouping... really the intent behind it was to help us be more accurate, and that's what we were really trying to accomplish. So,
very good, I think. Mr. Fenimore will make sure that Ernie gets a copy of this.
Okay. My last action item is the Mineral Mountains hunt structure. This motion was made by Jake Albrecht in December of 2012. I move that we ask the division to study the issues and concerns of making the Mineral Mountain Range west side of Beaver Unit a limited entry buck deer unit, and that it be discussed during the revision of the deer plan with the Deer Management Committee. This is to be placed on the action log. So to begin, for those not familiar with the Beaver Unit, Unit 22, I put together a map. It's split by I-15, so you have Beaver East, which has great summer range. That's where our mountain goats are as well. And then on the west, I highlighted in yellow where the Mineral Mountains are, just to give some reference as to to where we're speaking of. Give some background on this unit. The population objective is 11,000. Our current estimate is 12,400. And our current management strategy is to manage for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. Our three-year average is 16.7. And last few years, we've cut permits. And last year, our buck-to-doe ratio was 17.8. So we're getting there. That's correcting. Last year, 3,150 hunters harvested over, nearly 1,100 bucks. And 92% of the unit is public land. But with that said, there are some important private holdings that deer use. And so there are some depredation issues as well on that west side and something we need to be aware of. There's limited deer migration between the east and west portions of I-15, most of which takes place post-hunt on the north end. So just to give a little bit more biological background of the unit. In fall 2014, we issued 3,000 buck permits, and this isn't one of the units where we have radio collars for survival and different things like that, but generally understood that about 75% of the deer are on the east and 25% on the west. That's, again, not a whole lot of data to support that, but that's the general understanding. And if we were to go from 18 bucks per 100 does to a limited entry to 30, oftentimes the question is, what does that do to permits? And we ran some analysis on that, and if you took that unit and took it from 750 general season permits to manage for 18 bucks per 100 does, over about a five-year period, you would have a 49% reduction in permits over time. And what we'd have to do the first couple years is drastically reduce permits. I mean, go from 750 to 200 to really let that buck-to-doe ratio climb. And then once it's stabilized at 30, we could go to about 350, 375 permits. So that's the understanding of that on what it would do with permits. The history, this idea came up from the Southern Region RAC in November 2012 by a member of the public. And shortly after that, the Southern Region, they received a petition with over 1,000 signatures asking for the unit to remain general season. It was discussed at the Deer Committee meeting in September, and there were mixed opinions. There were individuals on the committee that liked the idea of having another limited entry unit, and then others opposed it. And really, consensus wasn't reached on this issue. Some of the committee members didn't have enough knowledge of the unit to say, yeah, I feel really strongly it should be this or that. Questions about exact boundaries, movements of deer, and some of those things. Some had concerns about going limited entry simply because of the petition that was submitted from the local public that hunted general season west of I-15 there. And so they said, well, you've kind of already heard from the public in that regard, guys that hunt that area. And then what we did as a committee is we got stuck like this, and where should we go? We referred to a survey that we did prior to the Mule Deer, well, actually not prior, with the Mule Deer Committee. We wrote a survey, gave it to the public, and got some feedback. And one of the questions that we asked is, what would you like to see on the following units? And if I can draw your attention to the red portions, those represent limited entry. And so about 12-13% said they wanted fewer limited entry units. Just over 50% said they wanted no change, and about a third said they wanted more limited entry. And with that, the committee really didn't recommend one way or the other, and just kind of keep it status quo is the direction we went. In conclusion, the division does not recommend converting the Mineral Mountains to a limited entry hunt structure simply because of the survey results, where we asked over 9,000 hunters how they want it, and there wasn't overwhelming support for more limited entry, and the petition that we received from the local communities there. But with that said, you know, the division recognizes that there is a demand for additional limited entry hunting. A third of the survey said they would support more limited entry units, and in the November RACs and December Wildlife Board, we will propose strategies for additional limited entry hunting opportunity. And it's kind of thinking outside the box a little bit, but it gets away from, okay, we're going to make that choice of this is general season, now it's limited entry. We'd like to explore some high country buck hunts that you would use limited entry points on, that we could potentially harvest bucks that are leaving the state and we just have to get creative on season dates before they head to Wyoming and places like that, and some later season hunts on general season units that, again, could be a limited entry hunting opportunity. So.
Okay. We usually don't get comments from action log items, but I have one comment card here from Ryan Thompson. I'm going to allow him to come up and talk for 3 minutes, and then we'll have a little discussion from the Wildlife Board and move forward. Ryan? Please state your name, where you're from.
Ryan Thompson. I'm from Melford. I'm here representing Melford Wildlife Association. We're the ones that put the petitions out. We feel that it would take a tremendous amount of opportunity away from the general public. Like to see things stay the way they are.
We really can't hear. I'm sorry.
Hey, lift that mic up a little bit.
Just a little closer.
Need to start over?
No, you're good.
Okay, I guess we as the Melford Wildlife Association, we oppose the making of the Mineral Mountains limited entry. Simple fact that it does take away a lot of opportunity from the general public. They're in Melford and Beaver County. The deer hunt is a very family-oriented. I guess it's kind of a holiday, and we'd like to keep it that way and keep the hunting opportunities involved with the public. And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ryan. Okay, Justin. I know that this is going to, your deer committee thing is going to be brought back in November through the RAC, and this will probably be brought back up by people, or maybe it won't, I don't know. There might be some others. So I don't think there's a lot of need to do much more about this today and see whether your mule deer plan comes through the way that you think it will or whatever. Your opinion? Good?
Yeah, we're open to all this. I mean, as we take these things through the public process,
And when that RAC meeting comes around, there'll be some other things brought up, so we might as well wait to see what those are. Okay, very good presentations this morning.
Thanks for your time, Mr. Chair, and board, and the rest of the board.
Bill, do you have anything else?
No, thank you, Justin.
Okay, for those who have come in late, or I failed to mention, if you want to comment today, you need to fill out a comment card like this. Turn it into Stacy over here, and we'll get you on the being able to comment list. So I'm going to turn the time over to Director Sheehan for DWR update. And at the end of this, I have a couple of comments I'd like to make also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Justin, thanks for the update on those action log items. So hopefully we've cleared a bunch of those off the list, but I know there's more on there that you want addressed, and we'll continue working towards those. I'm going to cover a few dates of events coming up and a couple of other issues here, and then I'll give some aquatics updates to kind of lead us into the discussion on the fishing guidebook that we've got next on the agenda. First item I wanted to make everyone aware of is we have been monitoring a wolf that's living in northeastern Utah. That came into the state that we first identified. It was seen by a hunter back during the archery hunt, so mid-August. That wolf does have a radio collar on it, and it's traveled down into Utah from a pack that's up on the Canada-Idaho border. So it's a very venturesome wolf. And it's got an old collar on it, meaning the beacon or the signal that we receive off of that wolf tends to be fading. So if we can't get very close to it, we don't know where it's at. But it has been living over north of Vernal and the Uintas there, and kind of northwest a little bit of Vernal. And as of last week, we cannot no longer find a signal on that. So it's either moved out of this country or the radio caller is finally dead on it. We have, like I mentioned, had a hard time tracking that. We've asked the Fish and Wildlife Service if that's a wolf that they would be interested in capturing and returning to the northern Idaho region. I think at this point in time they're not interested in moving that wolf. My suspicion, because it's a single wolf, is that it's probably out looking for a new pack somewhere, and it probably won't stick around here in our state too long. So I'm guessing it will either head over into Colorado or head back where it came from at some point soon. That's been seen multiple times by hunters out there and observations that we've done, and we're pretty certain that that's a single wolf. It's a male wolf.
Can I ask a question about wolves?
Uh-huh.
What's the status on the decision of the wolf delisting? Is that still being considered?
Last June 8th, a year ago, June 8th, 2013, the service proposed a formal rule to delist the gray wolf throughout the country and then relist the Mexican wolf subspecies. We went through a public comment period, which closed last January, I believe, and then the service is in an evaluation period on the final rule, whether they will opt to delist that or not. They have indicated to me they took 1.6 million public comments on that, and it is taking longer than they expected to go through the public comments. The majority of those were sort of auto-generated on both sides of the issue, but the ones that have more substance and aren't repetitive in nature, they, of course, are spending time looking at those. We continue to apply pressure to the service to allow them to know that the state of Utah is still very interested in regaining state authority for wolf management, as it's been granted to Idaho, Montana, and until last week to Wyoming. A federal judge last week had a question in part of the state plan of Wyoming, and so they remember the judge's name. I think it's Judge Carter, but I may be wrong on that. She did relist the wolves in Wyoming until that plan could be appropriately modified. I think the commission in Wyoming has made those changes. The governor's filed an executive order, and so I suspect that will work its way back through the court, and they'll be delisted again in Wyoming. So that's the status.
But they haven't given you any kind of indication when they might be able to make a decision.
We'd hoped by January, this coming January, they would release that, but the indications I'm getting are they won't be doing it then without any certain time to beyond that.
So. Two questions. One, would there be any value in trying to catch this one wolf and putting a new collar on it and releasing it just so you'd be able to track it better and see where it's going and so forth?
That would probably need to be done by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're the ones here. Have it collared now, and we've asked them what they want to do, and I don't think they're too much interested in doing anything with it right now.
So. And the second is, are we going to reconvene that wolf working group and redo the wolf plan? That's expiring, right?
The wolf plan will expire next year. We'll bring something out probably in December through a RAC board process, but we do have a state plan in place now for wolves, and because of the uncertainty of where we're at in all this, more likely than not, I don't think we'll revisit the plan, but probably just ask you all for an extension of our existing plan until we have better certainty about where the Fish and Wildlife Service is going. I don't see the need to open up a huge, you know, public process right now when we don't know exactly where we're at on it. So,
is that collar on that wolf? Is that just a VHF collar? Is it a GPS
collar? I think it's a GPS collar. Yeah, it's a GPS collar. Boyd, did I make that accurate update on that wolf? Anything new in the last few days?
So. Everything was dead on.
Okay. So.
Like you were there.
Like I was there. At some point, we will expect to see the GPS data download from the service, whoever's got that, and it'd be interesting to see the path and where it's been and going and all. So, okay. Next item to report. Calvin Crandall, who's on our board here, was reconfirmed by the State Senate for another term on the board. Came in a few years ago after. You know, I didn't ask that.
Pretty sure it was a unanimous vote.
Calvin came in kind of in a midterm situation when Tom Hatch resigned from the board, so kind of created a timing flux. So that was a reconfirmation by the Senate on his seat here. We're coming up on some youth hunts. We've got a youth pheasant hunt October 11th that will occur around the state. Our website has all the locations. We'd encourage folks to get youth out on that. And also on November 8th, there's a effort that SFW puts on every year to get youth out there on some of the WMAs in the state. And I think that's the date. Someone, SFW, Byron or somebody, is that the accurate date, November 8th? I think so. Yeah, so they offer one as well in partnership with the division. So we hope you get the youth out there, and that's a great opportunity. As well, we'll be releasing pheasants in November, the general opener this year, somewhere around 11,000 birds again, mostly pheasants, but some chucker. The pheasants would primarily be all roosters. We did a day-old chick program again this year, the second year. In the spring, where we allowed individuals in the public, sportsmen's groups, to come in and get these birds, and that's really been a big success. And they're raising those birds on their own dime and getting those birds out for hunters. Milford Wildlife Association, is he still? Ryan, are you still here? I think they did 700 pheasants down there, but throughout the state, we've got a lot of folks that are doing that and creating a lot of interest and excitement in pheasants in the state. So.
Was there a good turnout on the duck youth hunt?
Yeah, I was going to mention that. We had a huge turnout on the two events. One is the youth waterfowl day, which is a preparatory day before that, and we went from around, and that's put on by many, many partners here in the state, the Waterfowl Association, the Airboaters, SFW, on and on. There's lots of them, and then there's lots of sponsors. But that last year we had about 1,100 people come out to that. Those numbers were up this year. I think we increased the youth that came out from 650 to like 800 youth this year. And then the following weekend was the youth waterfowl hunt, and our numbers were up everywhere. The harvest was very good. We have lots of waterfowl. We're at all-time highs in our waterfowl in the state, so we expect a great waterfowl hunt this year. Our other hunts going very well. Our deer are doing super in the state right now. There's nowhere that I've heard of that we aren't expecting to see increased success of deer numbers and quality of bucks, big bucks. We're seeing numbers come in now and pictures and all those things that happen in the fall with the deer and elk. And it's going to be a great year. So those of you who have a deer tag or an elk tag should be pleased with what you're seeing out in the field this year. Just kind of a heads up, we've had a lot of bear depredation issues this year. We pretty confident that our bear numbers in the state have been growing quite a bit, and they seem to be in many places of the state getting into quite a bit of trouble. So as we bring out bear recommendations in a couple months, expect to see some increased numbers, but also some different strategies on how we allow the public to pursue bear, and I won't go into that anymore at this point, but be prepared for that, and that will always bring a little bit of public controversy when we talk about changes there.
Our chairman reduced that number by one this year.
That's right. They did get a bear. So. Okay, let's jump into some angling related topics. First of all, an update on license sales. For the year, our license sales are pretty consistent with where they were last year. But on July 1, we had a number of changes that took place. We had some fee increases that kicked in, but we also had some decreases in some permits. We lowered the price of youth fishing licenses and created a category for kids that are 14 to 17. They used to have to pay the same as an adult. Because of that, we've seen an increase of 16,000 permits in that range this year, so we're very excited about that, and hopefully that's helping our youth be more motivated and more affordable to get involved. We're selling fewer seven-day licenses. We think that some of those are shifting to the season-long licenses, which, again, is something we would rather see people buying these longer-term documents than the short-term. Probably the biggest change we had this year is we are allowing our public to purchase multi-year licenses. So historically in Utah, you've been able to buy a one-year license. Long time ago, we had lifetime licenses, but more recently, for the last 20 years or so, it's only been a one-year. This year, you can now buy one-year, two-year, three-year, four-year, or five-year license. And looking at the numbers on those, as a percent of the overall sales since July 1, it's still pretty low, to be honest with you. We have sold about 3,100 multi-year licenses, but just as a kind of a point of interest, the majority of those multi-year licenses that are being sold are two-year licenses. The second highest category is five-year licenses, and then three-year and the four-year licenses we've sold very few of. So I guess if people want to go all in and do multi-years, they're going all the way to five. But I think that will catch on as we move forward, and that's a great way for us to keep people interested in those fishing opportunities year after year. Here within the next week or so, the division will be rolling out a smartphone application. And that'll be the first one of those that we have in the state, and hopefully we'll advertise that at some point and get people aware of it. But that application will have some simple functionality. It'll talk about opening times for shooting hours. It'll have pictures of the different duck species. It'll have pictures of all of our different fish species on there, so people can refer to that. But more importantly, it will allow you to have downloaded onto your phones all of your license documents. So you can get all your hunting and fishing, anything that you've purchased through us, licenses will be available on your phone, and along with the expiration dates and things. At some point, I expect that we'll make that be the legal, we'll have to work through a rule on that, but that you'd be able to display that on your phone to a conservation officer rather than carrying a lot of paper around. So that's kind of the way we're shifting. I think we're one of the first states in the country that's been as proactive on this. A couple other things, those who draw particular hunting permits, a limited hunting permit, rather than just knowing what unit it is for, say, Boulder elk or something like that, you can actually tap on it, and it will bring up the aerial maps of that, so you'll know where the boundaries are and that sort of thing, and be able to look at that on your phone. You'll be able to go in and look at your status of bonus points and preference points that you have and a number of other features. So I think this is sort of the new age of technology, and we're glad to be one of the first to the table with an app that's going to be, you know, highly useful for you as you worry about when's that fishing license going to expire, that combination or whatever you may have in your wallet. So, Kenny, did I cover most of the elements of that?
So does that mean then when we, if I go to tag an animal, I just strap my phone to his antler?
That's
then?
What we're is thinking.
That, is that okay? Yeah. That's what I thought. That's what Steve and I were discussing. That thought that would be an interesting.
Well, they'll have their own phones, and so the tag will just show up.
It'll just show up on the animal. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Great. There you go.
Just text that deer that you're going to shoot.
Have a QR code and just scan it in there, and it'll be done, won't it?
But yeah, that is, you know, an evolving world that we're in on some of that automation, and
That's awesome. That's great.
Think it'll be fun. And those should be rolling out on the Android platforms and iPhone, iTunes platforms, hopefully within the next week or so. So we're pretty excited about that. Next March, and we'll work with the board members here on a date. We'd like to have a day, and we've talked about having days in this interim. We usually have a board meeting about the first few days of January, and then we don't meet again until late April, early May. There's a pretty big gap, and One thing we'd like to do is spend some time on a day and talk about some of the different aquatics efforts that are going on in this state. We don't often talk a lot about those in the board, and there's some because there's not as many agendas that this gets worked through, and we think there's some important things. So we're going to see if we can get a day probably in March and spend that talking about some of the different waters and management plans and things that we've got around the state and where we're going with those sorts of things, because, again, you don't hear a whole lot about those here at the board, and I think that will be a very productive day, and we'll work with you on a date for that. Last week, we were at an event called OFWA, Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. They meet once a year. It was in St. Louis this year, and it's kind of the big annual wildlife conference in the country. One of the evenings of that, they do an annual awards presentation, and they'll hand out five or six awards to individuals or organizations. Those are pretty prestigious to earn. That association covers all of the Canadian provinces and all of the states in the United States, so it's not just a United States effort. This year we had an individual that we nominated and won one of those six awards, which is pretty prestigious because those other awards were gone to congressional folks in Washington, D.C., received a couple of those awards. Dingell, Congressman Dingell of the Dingell Johnson fame, received an award this year, and he's quite old now, but still in Congress. It's been there since the 1950s. But those are difficult. I think the governor and some of his folks, Montana Gower, but back to individuals we know of, Chris Penny, who's a Northern Region Aquatics Biologist, won the Young Professional of the Year Award. And again, state wildlife agencies in the United States only received two or three of those awards this year. The last time that anyone from Utah received an award in the OFWA process that's about 100 years old was 1980, Bud Phelps, who used to be here with the division, who had retired by then, actually, received an award 34 years ago. So we're pretty proud of receiving that award, and that's to Chris Penny from Northern Region Aquatics Biologist for the Young Professional of the Year. Couple of hatchery updates for you. We're in the process of likely closing one of our hatcheries, Loa Hatchery, that we've had to reduce production in recent years from New Zealand mud snail issues, as we've continued to ramp up production at many of our other hatcheries around the state that are doing quite well. Even with that hatchery shut down at some point, we'll still be hovering around all-time highs of fish production in the state. We hit 1.2 million pounds last year. We feel like our Egan hatchery, we just had raceway covers and got that back up and running and heading into full production on that. We're really hitting a time when all of our hatcheries are hitting full stride here, and that really is capable of producing a significant amount of fish in the state. So we're looking for efficiencies out there, and that's a hatchery which has great water source, but it's got some other challenges, as I mentioned, and we still feel like we won't really see any reduction in our overall fish production with that hatchery closed. And that will probably transition over the next year or so. I think, Roger, you're here. Is that accurate?
Yes.
About a year or so. But we wanted to make you aware of that. We've also been in discussions with the federal government as they've contemplated closing the Jones Hole Fish Hatchery. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. I think Congress has jumped in and helped make sure that was funded adequately. We were still in discussion with them about the type of fish that are grown there, but I think we're made good progress there. I was out there Tuesday afternoon, went down to that fish hatchery and saw what was going on out there. It was interesting that right below the below that hatchery, there's a stream called Jones Hole Creek that runs about 3.5 miles down to the Green River. It's one of the top fishing streams in Utah. Not many people ever work their way out there. It's quite remote. But two young men were coming up from fishing on there, and I was able to talk to them a minute. And they flew here from Tennessee. They come here twice a year, and that's their big thing that they do every year is they come out here a couple times, and they fish only Utah. and only our some of these top waters we have along the Green River and places. So, you know, oftentimes we receive feedback from some of our rural counties and all that, that wildlife's not putting economic impact that they'd like to see in the counties, and we share with them the you know, that all the work that we do out there, both in our terrestrial and aquatic species and the hunters and fishermen that come in pursuit of those, do bring a high economic value. They're just not seen. They're not seen every day at, you know, at school and church in those places. But these folks do come here. They spend a lot of money and spend a lot of time in our state. And we're working to make sure that they have a better understanding of that value that wildlife brings to the state. I'll move quickly here. We've got fish at Lee K Center, our tiger muskie that we're working on, which are muskie and northern pike. They're doing well out there. We opened that hatchery last January. I mentioned that Egan hatchery, the cover, was finished, and we'll have that a grand opening at some point soon. Couple things that we had anglers concerned about: losing our tiger muskie out of Newton Reservoir. So we've been able to screen that to keep those fish from leaving there. Duck fork fish trap for trapping Colorado River cutthroat trout. We were successful in getting a trap put in there, and that's the first we've ever had down there, and that went very well this year. So a lot of good things going on, and maybe most of all for those anglers out there, it's a great time to be fishing in Utah this fall as it is every fall. But I think we've got as many fish anywhere out there. Depending on what your interest is, go out and get those. So that was a bit of a long update, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take any questions if you have any otherwise.
Any feedback on the crow season that just finished its first run?
I have not had any feedback at all on that. I've not talked to anybody who participated in that hunt. I've not heard any public comments, concerns, good, bad, or whatever. So we'll make that part of our upland bird survey this year and see people went out and participated or not, but I've not heard anything. You know, one interesting thing, it reminds me, Bill's son, Billy Fenimore, texted me a picture last night and reported a bird species in Utah that has never been documented here at Farmington Bay, a sparrow, I believe. Help me out with that,
Nelson
Bill.
Nelson Shorttail Sparrow.
Why don't you give us an update? You can do it better
sparrow
than I could. So.
But it's always exciting to birders when something new shows up, and this is the first documented occasion of a Nelson sparrow showing up in Utah. So everyone that's been able to has been hiking out there to this spot out on Farmington Bay, and they're wishing duck season wasn't starting Saturday, because that may scare the sparrow back to where he come from when they start. But it was quite exciting. And also the division got some great press on the Condor Project down in southern Utah. It was really well documented and encouraging, the results that we're starting to see, and had our first baby condor this year too.
Yeah, first condor nesting in Utah that we've ever documented. So
we had a rare bird sighting in Price the other day too, out in our parking lot at the on the college campus. We had a blue grouse in the middle of town. I have no idea how it got there or why it got there, but there was another one seen in south of town, dusky grouse now. If you're old, it's still blue. But so there were at least probably two, maybe three. I think some hunter caught
part
them
and
brought them back down to town.
Part of our hunting recruitment program, let them know they're still around, go up in the mountains, and shoot a few. So that's all I've got, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. A couple other things. I'm going to let Calvin Crandall go first, and then I'll have one other discussion item.
A couple of weeks ago, I was made aware of an issue that's going on in Utah County, between Utah County and Juab County. There's been a number of livestock, specifically cattle, that have been shot up Payson Canyon over into Salt Creek Canyon east of Nephi. So there's been a group of individuals, group of cattlemen, come together called the Central Utah Livestock Association. You'll see a bunch of these signs going up. We just had these printed. I just picked this up last night. You've got this size, one a little bit smaller, one that's about a 3 foot by 3 foot, offering a $20,000 reward, leading to the arrest and conviction of anyone shooting or, you know, taking of any livestock. It's it's getting a problem. Right now, it's five counties, Utah, Juab, San Pete, Millard, and Tooele counties are the three counties that are participating in that. So you'll see a bunch of signs going up. Be aware of that. You know, this is, it's not really in conjunction with the DWR has a poaching hotline. Obviously, you know, if you see somebody out there shooting animals, you know, obviously 911, call a local sheriff. And we're having a hard time getting the local sheriffs realizing, hey, this is important. This is just as important as going out and keeping youth from binge drinking. You know, they'll go out and do that. They'll go out and, you know, send a dozen officers out there because they hear there's a beer party somewhere, but they won't send one officer to investigate a cattle shooting or any rustling. Dave Carter, the livestock investigator, says, I've got one case in Carbon County. He says, I think it's a slam dunk. I can't get the county prosecutor off dead center to get anything done because it's not really that big of an issue. It is a big issue. We're hoping that this reward will, you know, get these signs out there and get this reward out there that people will slow down or quit shooting, or they'll get somebody turned in and we can get a conviction on this. But it's an issue. So we would, you know, ask for the division's help with your conservation officers, with your hunters. If you see something out there, report it. If you see somebody out there with a trailer loading animals, stop and ask what's going on. If it's a legitimate concern, no harm done. If it's somebody out there picking something up, because livestock prices are pretty darn high right now. Highest that I have ever seen. Scratching my head wondering why and what and where. But anyway, if you see something out of the ordinary, let somebody know. It doesn't take much to investigate it. If the conservation officers see a dead animal, let somebody know what and where, and let's look into it. If it's a legitimate, something happened and it, you know, got sick and died on its own, or if somebody's out there shooting them, we'd like to know. So just kind of an FYI, heads up, you'll see these signs out there. If you see something going on, let us know. Thanks.
I hope certainly that none of our ethical sportsmen are in any way involved with this, unethical sportsmen. I hope that's not the case.
I hope that's not the case, too, and you never know. I know Dave Carter, the investigator, they've tried to find, they've seen an exit wound in and out of the animals. Some of them are really small, high caliber, probably a solid noise that's going straight through. Some of them have fragmented to the point where they can get bits and pieces. Can't find anything to get any kind of ballistic on it to find out what, but they know there's an issue out there, and we're a little concerned on it.
We'll help however we can.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, the other item, and I'm glad Kevin is still here, Kevin Bunnell. I've got some reports from the Beaver and the Tusher about helicopter harassment the last two or three weeks from down there, from people who have been goat hunting as well as mule deer hunting. And I'd like to know what the division's action is on that, where that's going. Kevin?
Yeah, we got the same reports, Jake, and looked into them. We had Hal Stout, our investigator, visit with the – there's two helicopter schools – operating out of Cedar City right now. We've visited with them about a year ago. Our lieutenant, Scott Delabout, went and talked to them, and they did admit that they had a new instructor that hadn't gotten the word about harassing wildlife and staying out of things, and we did have an incident on the Tushers about 2 weeks ago that sounds like you heard about, and we did as well. We've addressed that with them. They took it very seriously and are addressing it internally. I don't think any citations were issued at this time, but that's a possibility if things like this continue. So we're aware of it, and we've addressed it with our law enforcement folks, and I hope we have it taken care of.
Okay, so I hear of another one the other day from a gentleman out of Lyman that was over there hunting deer. You heard anything on that one?
The one we got was, we had a couple come in. It may have been, I know a goat hunter was one. I'll have to find out if the other one was in the Lyman area and see if that's the same report. Let's compare notes on those two and see if we're hearing the same things.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks, Kevin. Well, it's a quarter after 10, and we're to our first action log item. But before we start, with Drew on fishing guidebook and rule. Anybody that follows baseball knows that in the last couple of years, like Rivera and Derek Jeter have retired, you know, different things like that. Kevin, you got one other thing?
John Fairchild just reminded me. The one out of Lyman was actually we were catching bighorn sheep on the North Slope to try to, and that's, they were staging there at Hoop Lake, and that's where that one was a trying to get collars on the bighorn sheep on the North Slope of the Uintah. So that was a project that we were working on ourselves. So,
yeah, I'll compare notes with you afterwards.
Okay.
So last month, Mr. Fenimore and myself, is a little bit like Derek Jeter and Mo Rivera, were starting our last go-around. And last month was our Cougar meeting, and I didn't bring it up because I was afraid Byron Bateman would give me one of his hound dogs. But today is our last fish meeting, so I would hope that the division and Drew and some of the others could maybe give Fenimore and myself a lifelong carp tag or something like that. Maybe an insignia for our windows with a fishing, since I don't fish much. So. Anyway, Drew, you got the floor.
Oh, you guys be missed.
Well.
We'll have the carp tag, too.
Yeah, we can issue that.
We'll even give you a ride down to Utah Lake if you want to start. Yeah, we'll do a carp slam.
Buy a new pitchfork.
All right, this is the 2015 guidebook and rule. We meet once a year. I wanted to recognize Paul Birdsey, my counterpart. He's the cold water sport fish coordinator. My name, again, is Drew Cushing. I'm the warm water sport fish coordinator. I'm going to try and be thorough today. If I'm not, I'll apologize ahead of time. I have my boat loaded and going down to Lake Powell as soon as the gavel comes down, so I'll do my best, but I will be a little bit distracted. I feel like a kid at Christmas Eve. So, 2015, like the last couple years, we completed our regulation survey. This is in lieu of the spring informational rack, which we did a number of years ago. We didn't have the public participation in that spring rack meeting. So we discontinued that and went with this survey concept. And it stayed open for about a month, as is usual. And we had 1,300 responses to the survey on 13 questions. And then, additionally, 750 respondents provided comments in just kind of a free form. Write in what you think, any suggestions or comments for us. What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? We broke those out, and 294 of those comments were regulation changes, which we forwarded to our regional managers for their review and you know, for them to be thoughtful on those regulation changes. The rest were, or my fault, the regulation changes we'll discuss here in a second, and the management changes, which they recommended, were forwarded to the regional managers for their review. So in the write-in section, the number one most popular comment was the stream access, which I'm sure you all are aware of, and what they want is more access to streams for fishing. And the second most popular comment was, we need more law enforcement. And so those are just for your information. Then there were two novel responses that were just kind of interesting, and I noted them here. The one was to allow active military folks to fish or hunt without a license. And then the second was, after you reach 70 years old, you no longer need a license as well. And you guys are all kind of in that, except for Greg, maybe. Mike, but I want to be there one day, and maybe when I reach 70, we'll have that.
He wants us to.
Furthermore, there was a lot of interest in spearfishing, which has been kind of a topic at all of the racks and wildlife boards the last couple of years. And basically, most of the people who took part in this survey indicated they wanted less spearfishing. And there were quite a few respondents on there that wanted more spearfishing, but the majority discussed a need to limit spearfishing. Furthermore, this is a growing interest in Utah. Bow fishing for carp is definitely growing, but it seemed to be a pretty popular item in this write-in to allow bow fishing for all game fish. And so this is just something that we see as a growing interest and will probably be at RACs and Wildlife Boards here in the next year or two. And then over the past 10 years at least, we've seen a change in who our angling public is and what they want. And this is kind of going along with the other surveys that we've seen. There's a desire by the angling public to have more regulation, so more fly fishing only streams, more special restrictions, more slot limits, like at Strawberry and the Provo River. There's a disconnect between what they want and what they're really asking for. And I'll go through that a little bit later, but more regulation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get more quality fish. And I'll go through a couple examples later. What they really want, and I'll get to an exact survey that kind of defines this, they want larger fish. And they see regulation as a way to achieve that end, which isn't necessarily true. And like I said, we'll get into that in a little bit. Moving into statewide stuff. Last year, the legislature passed an allowance for disposal of certain fish in certain waters. Usually, this is reserved for those waters which have an illegal introduction or no limit, such as Lake Powell's a good example on striped bass, which overrun their forage, which is gizzard shad and threadfin shad, and then they decline in condition and basically get to a point where you can't eat them. They're just skin and bones. The best thing to do with those fish would be to, kill them and then return them to the water because you don't want them to deplete the forage any more than necessary. So with that in mind, we would like to add a couple waters and fish species in those waters to that list of disposal allowance. Blue Lake, Pacu were illegally introduced there. We've seen them for 2 years now. And Pacu, I'll show you a better picture, but they're a relative of the piranha. They eat vegetation and nuts and berries. They're an interesting fish, but there is a population out there that's reproducing, seems to be growing. And if someone does catch one, we'd like them to kill it and then dispose of it. Fish Lake, there's a management group put together in the southern region that dealt with Fish Lake as a fishery and the future of where that fishery is going. Part of that is to the survival and condition of rainbow trout has kind of declined. The return of those fish has declined. Yellow perch are super abundant in Fish Lake. Part of the management group recommendation was to decrease the perch population in Fish Lake and hopefully create more forage for other fish that anglers would like. And so disposal, this goes along with the second recommendation that we'll discuss in a minute, but we'd like to allow disposal of yellow perch at Fish Lake. And the third set of waters, Gunlock, Sand Hollow, and Quail Creek, they're in Washington County. We have an endangered fish program down there in the Virgin River and Santa Clara River Basin. And smallmouth bass were illegally introduced. They would be detrimental if they escaped into the river system. And as such, we would like anglers to be allowed to dispose of them and kill them on site. So with that, and I might note that those species or smallmouth bass are, according to that recovery program, prohibited for us to manage anyway. And so this is just our statement that says we won't manage them in that river system. Okay, we had a Wildlife Board action item last year to explore the allowance of spearfishing at all waters that have catch and kill regulations in place for those species that have that catch and kill regulation on them. We explored that. We actually added that as a question in that survey that we just completed. And the only waters that aren't on there already would be the Green River for burbot, Utah Lake for northern pike. And then the Virgin River waters, Gunlock, Quail, and Sand Hollow. The survey was balanced, I guess, on the Sand Hollow or the Virgin River waters. It was basically on Utah Lake and Northern Pike. It was supported. And on Sand Hollow, Gunlock, and Quail, there was a pretty good mix. But we asked GROGA, which is the Green River Outfitters and Guides Association, the U.S. Forest Service, about this issue on the Green River. And the Green River, as you might know, is heavily used by fly fishing, floaters, and is one of the most popular brown trout fisheries we have. And they felt that there would be a conflict on the Green River. State Parks was ahead of us on this. They actually had completed a survey that they did to people who entered those state parks down there at Sand Hollow, Gunlock, and Quail Creek. The users of those waters who use those waters specifically were opposed to this. And so, as such, we would like to recommend no change at this time. In any waters that we deem necessary or would be brought to us by spearfishing groups, we would, address those on a case-by-case basis and address those based on the biological risks as well as the social risk associated with those specific waters at that time. In preparation for this, we did some exploration, and we went and looked at all of the states we could that identified spearfishing in their guidebook or rule. And this is just for your information. Six states have explicit prohibitions on spearfishing, which means, you can't do it in that state. 31 states allow spearfishing for non-game fish only. Those are your carp and suckers or unprotected fish. And then one state allows spearfishing for non-game fish, but only with a special license. And then five states allow spearfishing pretty much the same way Utah does. It's on a case-by-case basis. They allow some waters and some species, but not all species and all waters. The remaining, that doesn't add up to the total states in the union. The remaining states, we couldn't find spearfishing anywhere, which implies that it's either, allowed or it's prohibited. But we didn't make that judgment. And give you a little history on underwater spearfishing in Utah. Before 2008, there was a limit that was specific for spear fishermen. That limit was that you could harvest one fish over 22 inches and one fish under 22 inches. That was different than what the rest of the anglers in Utah could go and harvest. It created some discrepancy on many of our waters. The one that came to mind first and foremost was our tiger muskie regulation, which a regular angler could only take one fish over 40 inches anywhere in the state. However, a spear fisherman could go and possibly take one under 22 inches, tiger muskie, and then one over 22 inches. If that second fish, the one over 22 inches, was under 40, he would have two illegal fish in his possession that normal anglers couldn't harvest. So we adjusted that. We applied the same limits that all fishermen had to spear fishermen as well to kind of balance the playing field, make sure that everybody was being treated the same. Pre-2008, there were 12 waters open to spearfishing. That year, because of some spearfishing interest, we added two additional waters, and currently there are 22 waters open to spearfishing statewide. These are for game fish only. You can go anywhere in the state that's open to fishing and spearfish for carp. And so you could really, it's statewide, but these waters are just for sport fish. And on the left there is a good picture of a pacu. You notice that it has molars and is a vegetarian by trade. They get quite large. And this, again, is Blue Lake. Not that picture, but these fish exist in Blue Lake. And this is an illegal introduction. And we would like to allow spearfishing for those fish. Spearfishing is allowed for tilapia out there already. And we would just allow allow spear fishermen to have this opportunity as well.
How big do these fish get?
They get quite big, 10, 15, even 20 pounds.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, they get large. And Blue Lake seems to be a pretty good fit for them. It's a warm water spring out there, and they seem to be doing quite well. Okay, a second Wildlife Board action item was to explore the allowance for unlimited at-home possession. These are the fish that would be in your freezer, which is kind of funny. We've gone to all the racks, and at the most explicitly the Northeast Region rack, and we told them what was legal now, and a couple of the rack members looked at us and said, "My God, I better go home and check my freezer." So this is a good thing for everybody to be aware of. Currently, you can only have in your possession at home, the 2-day possession limit, which we passed last year. Anything beyond that is against the law. So last year we were asked to explore this unlimited at-home possession, which would mean that once the fish reached your freezer, as long as you didn't violate your 1-day or 2-day possession limit, they ceased being part of your possession, which means you don't have to count the fish in your freezer to go back out and go fishing. So we completed the survey. There was good support for this change on the survey. The next step was to go to our managers' meeting with all of our regional aquatic managers and roundtable this and see what their thoughts were. At that meeting, there were some concerns on specific waters on applying this to trout mainly. And one of them was in the southern region, Panguitch Lake, Otter Creek, and Paiute. You know, we have out-of-state anglers that frequent those waters, stay 2 or 3 weeks, and the thought was that our trout population could be impacted there. We don't know that, but we'd like, you know, they wanted the opportunity to see whether that would be true or not. However, underharvest is an issue on many of our warm and cool water fisheries, our largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, bluegill, walleye. We've seen a decrease in harvest over the past 10 years. So we felt like it could be a management benefit for us in for those species right now. What we'd like to do is change for warm and cool water species and then explore these cold water fish over the next couple years, at least some fisheries. We have 2 creel surveys that we're completing right now, one on starvation, and we just completed one on Willard Bay. Starvation has cold water fish and warm water fish both. It has, you know, yellow perch, it has smallmouth bass, walleye, and then it has rainbow trout and brown trout as well. If indeed this causes a change in people's behavior, we would be able to identify that change over between this creel and a follow-up creel after this is implemented. It gives us an opportunity to move into this cautiously and one step at a time instead of, you know, implementing this for trout and warm and cool water fish as well. The other one is Willard Bay, which is strictly warm water. But once again, we have that data on how many fish people harvested before this was implemented. If we do implement this, it would give us an opportunity to see whether their harvest behavior changed. So in order to do this, we need to do a couple things. We need to, the first part there, the warm and cool water fish species, so all fish that are not trout, which is already defined in our rule, at your permanent residence, do not count as part of your possession limit. That's how the change would read. In order to do that, we need a definition to where that would take place, because we want to make sure that people know it's not your camper, it's not your motorhome, and it's not your cabin. And so in order to do this, a second definition is needed, a permanent residence definition, which is the domicile an individual relies on upon establishing residency for the purposes of this code. Now, I talked to our AG, who's in the audience, and we had a discussion yesterday about there's a group of people that might be impacted by this definition, and so this may not be the final definition. The instance that we're talking about, or we talked about before the meeting, was a person who moves from another state today, moves to Utah, buys a house. This definition doesn't fit those people unless he goes back to his residence in the other state. So we need to make sure that this is something that applies to people in all instances, that it's their permanent residence. Capture that right, Greg?
Pretty close. I can clarify for
you. You guys need a clarification, or are you good with that?
We'll probably do that under some of our questions and comments.
Okay, perfect. Okay, moving into the region by region changes or recommendations. The southern region, Fish Lake, I mentioned this work group that was put together. It was about a 6-month effort. They did a fantastic job, and the group that they put together was really novel in their approach to Fish Lake. If you're not familiar with Fish Lake, it's a major reservoir in the southern region. Historically, it was a rainbow trout fishery. Yellow perch were introduced there illegally. Furthermore, there was a Eurasian milfoil that is a vegetation that overruns many fisheries. It was moved there probably by anglers on their boats or in their live wells. It basically makes a ring around the lake where shore anglers can't access these fish, and gives these yellow perch a place to spawn and a place to hide. So in order to do this no limit on yellow perch, there's a milfoil weevil which they've initiated use on to reduce the milfoil. They feel like in other instances they've reduced it by 70%. If they do that, and we've transplanted yellow perch from Fish Lake to other fisheries to benefit those fisheries, if they can reduce yellow perch in Fish Lake, they could go in with other species that are probably more suited for Fish Lake. Most notably, the most recent idea was to establish a kokanee population in Fish Lake. This would give the lake trout a forage. They would be able to reproduce within the reservoir like they do at Strawberry and the Flaming Gorge. The problem is with the yellow perch there may not be enough zooplankton to support these fish, and so we need to reduce those. As such, this no limit on yellow perch would help us do that, along with these other efforts that we're undertaking. The second is just a change of what's already there. Right now, the limit is 4 fish. But this over 24 is currently over 28, and this is just a reduction. The group felt like once those fish reach 24 inches, they change to a fish diet, they grow quickly, and they achieve trophy growth at that time, and so it'd be a protection to allow those fish to reach trophy size, which if you ask people on the survey which was completed down there, what's the number one reason they go to Fish Lake? It's for trophy lake trout. Not very many people catch trophy lake trout, but you know, that's their number one most sought-after thing of going there. Furthermore, in the southern region, Lake Powell, this is just common sense. Striped bass can be disposed of. They, like we talked earlier, oftentimes they get so thin that they can't be utilized as food by anglers. But, you know, we have an allowance to return them dead to the water. This would just allow those same fish that you're returning to the water dead to be used as chum or bait, which just makes sense. It makes a lot of sense to us, and it should make sense to the anglers as well. Also, there's a group put together in the southern region this last winter to discuss the Boulder Mountain lakes and reservoirs, which if you've ever read our guidebook, you understand that it's fairly complicated to understand the definition of the Boulder Mountain description. And furthermore, the management on those waters prior to this recommendation were complicated. Oftentimes, there were regulations in place for reservoirs because they were lumped together instead of identified explicitly that didn't fit those individual reservoirs. So the first step is just to remove the boundary description, which right now is about a half page. And so that'll come out. And then the second part is just to apply these waters that we have special restrictions that are recommended by this group to be identified individually. So you'd go to the water specific section and the water that these regulations would apply for would be identified there. And then statewide regulations, of course, would be applied to those that are not listed in the specific water section. So getting to it, the first thing is there was a closure largely across the Boulder Mountains to ice fishing. Now, this list of waters, I won't name them, but this list of waters are on the Boulder Mountains, and these would be the only waters that are closed to ice fishing. All of the other 80 waters would be open, and so this is both an allowance, additional opportunity for anglers, and a simplification of what's taking place there. The reason that these waters are recommended to stay closed is that they're relatively small. A lot of them have springs that come up from underneath the reservoirs that anglers know about, and during the winter, when you can walk out and go right over the top of a spring where those fish accumulate, you could impact that fishery in pretty short order, or these fisheries. Oak Creek Reservoir in the southern region, also known as Upper Bounds, right now it has smaller brook trout in it. One of the thoughts of this group was to remove fish in order to create larger, more attractive fish to anglers. So this would be step one. If this doesn't work, the 16 limit on brook trout, the follow-up would be potentially a chemical treatment in the future if we can't get on top of them. And then go in with perhaps sterile brook trout or some other species that you could achieve that growth that the anglers wanted in this group. In the southern region, these are Virgin River and Santa Clara River reservoirs, Sand Hollow, Gunlock, and Quail Creek. Once again, smallmouth bass were illegally introduced in those waters. And according to the recovery program and our desire and our protection of those endangered fish, we would like to implement a catch and kill regulation on those fish in those waters. Southern region again, this has been about a 3-year, Jake, at your last wildlife board meeting, came to completion. These were not allowed to be open to spearfishing historically because of some access issues. The Southern region has worked diligently over the past couple years with the land management agencies. And as such, we're going to remove that closure. And so ice fishing would be allowed at Aspenmere Lake, Duck Creek, and Duck Creek Springs reservoirs. Also in the Southern region, we have a tiger muskie fishery there, Johnson Reservoir. Historically, we've had a limitation. Basically, you could only use a 1-inch by 1-inch or smaller piece of bait for tiger muskie. The thought was that it would not allow or not promote these deep-hooked fish and reduce this delayed mortality we see, and you know, from deep-hooked fish hooked in the gills, handling time. However, there was extensive research that was completed recently that indicated that tiger muskie, larger bait, they don't take as deep in the mouth, easier to release, less hooking mortality. So we'd just like to remove that limitation and allow people to use larger bait as long as it's legal to do so as they see fit. Northeast region, again, tiger muskie waters, Bullock and Cottonwood reservoirs. We'd just like to remove that bait restriction and allow anglers to use those larger baits to perhaps save the life of a tiger muskie out there, which are quite valuable. Blue Lake, again with the Paku, illegal introduced. We already talked about the spearfishing. We would like to implement a catch and kill regulation on Paku at Blue Lake. Once again, it was an illegal introduction, and we've done this with all of our other illegally introduced fish. Bear Lake, this is just to make sure that we're in line. We did away with our 2-rod permit this last year. And Idaho still has one. We would just like to make anglers aware that if you're fishing on the Idaho side of Bear Lake, that you adhere to Idaho laws and regulations. They still have the 2-rod permit. If you fish up there with 2 rods, you'd probably get a ticket, and we'd like to make sure that people are aware that you still need one. This is just really making sure that what we desire is what we actually have on the ground and have in our regulation. The Logan River, we have a special regulation in place. However, there's a couple ponds there, Tony Grove Lake and White Pine Lake, which are basically community fisheries, if you will. They're a place where bait anglers can go and you know, take fish, and it's a good place to introduce people who are novice anglers to an experience on the Logan River. The intent of this special regulation was never to restrict those waters, so we just want to make sure that people know that at those two lakes you can use bait, and it's just your basic statewide 4-fish limit. We have a brand new community fishery in Wellington. Paul Birdsey and I actually went by and took a look at it. It's quite nice. It's a nice place and well needed. As such, and it's going to be open, I believe, January 1 this coming year. And as such, we would just recommend that the regular community fishery limit is implemented on this night ideal community fishing pond. All right, that's the end of the regulation recommendations. However, I just wanted to get into some specifics on what we were talking about earlier. Earlier on the survey that we did, the online survey, the anglers indicated that they wanted more regulation. And we completed this survey that I've kind of laid out here this last spring using just a private company, a marketing firm. Their name is PPBH, which I don't know what that means. You know, just saying PPBH is hard enough. What anglers said they wanted in there, their number one priority for selecting where to fish, at least active anglers, is that they want good-sized fish, which at times flies in the face of a more restrictive regulation. I'll give you a specific example here in just a second. So their number one priority is good-sized fish. Number two is that when they go there and they want to catch a largemouth bass, that they actually feel like they have an opportunity to catch a largemouth bass or do catch a largemouth bass at that water. Third, kind of middle of the road, is this lots of fish. And so as you can see, Our angling constituents want, you know, larger fish. They don't necessarily want a lot of small ones. The lapsed angler side of things is a little bit difficult right now for me to understand. Their number one priority on going to a place, or for these guys, why they don't go anymore, is crowding. And I'm not sure that a lapsed angler's idea of crowding is the same as my idea or your idea of crowding, because my idea of crowding is on the water. And we don't know what these guys mean, whether it's highway crowding, parking, access. We just have no idea. So we need to follow up on this and see what indeed this crowding is to them and see if we can address it. And then number two, again, you see that they have a desire for larger fish. What's kind of interesting is the mercury issue seemed to be bottom of the line, which means either the anglers have already eaten too much and they don't recognize it as a threat anymore, or indeed they go fishing and they do what they need to do and they don't feel that it impacts their ability to fish and harvest fish. All right, this growth that we're talking about in fish, this is just one example. I'll give you a couple others as we're going through this. This is some aging growth that was completed at Willard Bay recently. Now, this is one kind of, and you don't want to call it stunting. You just want to say that at a point in their life, they end up lacking resources to grow any further. Most of you may not know, but fish grow or should grow through their whole life. From the day they're born to the day they die, fish can continue growing, unlike mammals. And so what you'd like to see in this growth model is, you know, starting at age zero, one continuous line diagonal through time. That means that every day of their life they're getting food and they continue to grow. Now, this is an example of a fish that early in its life through age four grows quite well. But if you notice, those fish at age 4 to 5, all of those, channel catfish, wiper, and walleye, stop growing. And so a 5-year-old fish in Willard Bay is largely the same size as a 10, 12-year-old fish, which shouldn't be the case. Wipers are a good example of a fish that, under the right circumstances, get quite large. Colorado catches, they have in many of their wiper waters, 20-pound fish. This is an example, just one example, of a situation where the fish run out of resources, can't continue to grow like they should. The other thing we tend to see in Pelican Lake and some of these others is actually if you take this curve and you flip it upside down, where you can imagine that the younger fish don't have enough resources and so they don't grow at all until most of them die. And then at some point in their life, usually, you know, when they have to make that transition from zooplankton to fish as food, then the survivors end up growing quite well. But sometimes it takes them 7, 8, 9, 10 years to thin out enough where they actually achieve that growth. And so when we're talking about, you know, this possession at home thing, and we're talking about, you know, what anglers desire, a lot of times a restrictive regulation actually compounds this because you end up keeping more fish in the fishery, which even further slows the growth down and creates a situation where people, when they, an angler's misinterpretation of what they see in this instance would be everybody's taking the bigger fish. You know, that's why an angler would look at this and say, if they didn't look at this graph and didn't look at this age and growth, they would interpret this as somebody's taking all my big fish, when in fact they don't exist because there's not enough forage. The benefit here would be to remove fish at this early size to allow greater growth. And this is the end of my slides. There's a couple slides that the Southern Region has for some of their reintroduction of native fish that we can either do now, or we can discuss this presentation, and then Richard could give his couple slides.
I think we'd like to discuss this presentation.
Okay.
Questions from the board? I have a couple, but I'll wait if you guys got some.
Are there fish that will use the perch and reduce their populations in some of these places like Fish Lake and such?
There are fish, not in Fish Lake specifically. A place like Yuba would be an example where you have walleye that can, you know, actually keep on top of yellow perch. Starvation is another good example. So there are fish out there.
Any other questions?
Yes, I've got one. On your trout not being included in your fish in the freezer, Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? I don't really understand why you want to eliminate trout.
Well, warm water fish reproduce naturally. And right now we have about a 90-plus percent catch and release rate on our black bass. Our harvest on walleye is down. The trout, they don't reproduce naturally in a lot of cases. And what we'd like to do is just, you know, explore that, because if indeed a water like Panguitch Lake, if this change does impact people's behavior and they do harvest more fish, then it could impact a place like Panguitch Lake and some of these waters where people are more harvest oriented. We don't know that, but it's a potential. And if that happens, we have resource issues. And so what would probably be necessary if that happened would be, you know, some sort of limit reduction or, you know, some other reaction to that overharvest, which we just want to make sure that we know what we're getting into before we get into it. Because for our hatcheries, they do have a limitation, and they are the source for those fish in many of those waters that are at question.
How do you anticipate policing this and trying to find out whether or not something is occurring there that you're not happy with?
Well, the waters in question, the ones in, at least in the southern region, are trout only, and so they would be as is. We'd police it the same way we have historically. And then the warm and cool water fish, they're pretty easily identified in the freezer.
When you say the same way you have traditionally, is you go to people's freezers and make sure they don't have any fish in their freezer?
We have. Not very many times, but there have been three times that I'm aware of where we have actually gone into people's freezers. They've been for gross violations where people, you know, keep going back and going back and going back. And there have been three times that I'm aware of where that has taken place.
Yeah, there was quite a discussion over this topic at Southern Region Rack. So.
Yeah, it's, you know, the thing is you just don't know. And you don't know how people would respond to this, whether all of a sudden people go, you know what, I'm going to go take every fish I possibly can, or do people just keep doing what they're doing? And we just want an opportunity to kind of evaluate it before we step fully into it and apply it to the fish species that we really know that we need harvest.
Okay, thank you.
Got a question somewhat along that same line. With the Panguitch, Otter Creek, and what was the third one?
Paiute. Fitzed Bill?
Not
those two?
Okay. You know, you're concerned about out-of-staters coming in with their trailers and camping all summer long. Obviously, that's not their permanent domicile. So they can have a two-day possession until that fish is consumed, and then they can go out and catch more.
Yes.
So if they catch more than that, I mean, if they go in there and try and over-harvest the whole lake, then they're obviously in a violation, because that's not home. They can't have more than eight in their possession at any one time.
Yes.
Is that enforceable to go out there and say, hey, you know, you've been here a long time. Do you mind if I look to see how many you've got in your possession? And would that police itself, basically?
We have made that case before. It does. And you're kind of arguing the same thing that we've discussed internally. It's one of those things that happens. We know it happens. Mm-hmm. We try and do the best we can with enforcing it. Anglers slip through. I don't know that I answered your question.
Yeah.
But
no, it's
not easy to unravel.
Right.
The only thing that we're trying to do is kind of understand it before we jump in.
Sure.
Over our head.
Sure. And then you just mentioned, you know, basically in some waters, less fish equal bigger fish because there's more resources.
Yes.
Is that going to be you take more fish out, in theory they would grow larger, but you're afraid they're going to overfish and they're not going to live long enough to get big.
Yeah, the difference is, and maybe I didn't explain it enough, but our warm and cool water fish, they spawn on their own. Largely, you know, once you put largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, walleye in a water, they do their thing and they reproduce quite nicely. And all we have to do is monitor them, make sure that our regulations match what they do. Trout, we don't have that luxury. Panguitch Lake is almost solely reliant on stocking. And so when you take too many fish out of there, it means that, you know, our purse strings are cut largely, or our ability to manage or other waters are going to be, you know, perhaps impacted as well by stocking additional fish to make up for that harvest.
They don't reproduce on their own?
Not largely.
Not enough to keep them, to keep a population sustaining, so that's why you have to keep putting so many back in.
Yes, and that's the same for most of our trout waters, especially our reservoirs.
Okay.
Few points to clarify. Most of the fish, trout fish we stock are sterile when we put them in. I think around 80%, but
yeah.
Someone could correct me. The other thing is there's a couple questions about looking in people's freezers or trailers and all, and certainly we aren't engaged in any of that without the appropriate law enforcement.
Right, and say it's going to be pretty hard invasion of privacy.
Right.
Just say, hey,
so
you know,
we're
we
not
think
in
you're
kicking in any doors unless there's.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, you could go knock on a door and say, you know, we have noticed you've been here, you know, several weeks or all summer. Just an FYI, you know, this is what's going on. We don't want to come and request, but we may have to because we've seen you out here an awful lot, and there's only you or you and your, you know, two people. And think you can eat that many fish.
Right. The instances that I know of, it took a court order and a warrant to go into someone's house to make that case. You know, that's how difficult it is.
Is there an issue with the 16 trout limits in those places that you talked about? What happens? You're okay as long as you're at that lake, but what happens when you head back down the mountain to home? Do you become a violator at that time? How do you?
Yeah, we have issues like that currently. That's definitely an issue. The thing is that if you take 16 brook trout from Oak Creek Reservoir and you come home, put them in your freezer right now, you could not go back to a standard, you know, 4 trout limit brook trout water and take any more fish. As a matter of fact, you'd be in violation of the limit. The only
right.
place that you could go to would be Oak Creek Reservoir, somewhere where it had a 16 fish or greater limit, and then you could fish there. So we have that same issue. We have, you know, there's a number of those that we discussed, and you know, out-of-state folks, there's some waters that have no limit on crappie. Or Lake Powell's a good example with walleye, where there's no limit. You go down to Lake Powell, and you're doing what we want from a management standpoint by removing walleye. You come home, you put them in your freezer, automatically you can't go to Willard Bay or Yuba or Starvation, which, oddly enough, you know, it would be a benefit if people would harvest fish from there as well. And so it's just a conflict, and this would make that easier.
I noticed you're talking, you know, a lot of different waters, or some are open, some are closed. I haven't looked at the guidebook. How is it pretty easy to follow?
Yeah, it's
I mean,
actually
is it alphabetical by waters. These are open, these are closed, these are your regulations, or
yeah, it's actually
is it confusing?
No, the reason it's not confusing is there's only two maybe three steps to understanding, you know, what you have to do as an angler. Now, one is you say, okay, I'm going to Blind Lake, so you thumb back to the water or the list of waters that have special regulations, and you go ABC B. Blind Lake isn't there, that means I can keep 4 fish.
That means I'm just standard regulations.
Right.
Or if there is a certain special regulation, it will be listed right there. You can take this, but not this.
Yes.
This is your limit. These are the, you know, whatever the regs are, it's there, and it's pretty easily understood.
It is. Two steps, and you could get through that proclamation.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Drew, if I seen your slide right, you had a slide in there that said you'd want to try this for a couple of years and then you'd revisit it in 2016.
Yeah.
On the trout issue, am I correct there?
Yeah, right there. Well, we have those two krill surveys that I discussed, one at Starvation and then one at Willard Bay. What we'd like to do is just give us a year to, you know, to even if it's just a partial krill, that we can compare, you know, month to month in 2 years of when they see maximum harvest, just to see if that's changed. And then in 2016, we would bring that information back and make a decision on the cold water things at that time. That way it's not lingering and we're not making any false promises. We just want to make sure that we do the best business.
Okay. So while I got you right there, is Richard's presentation part of yours or is his separate?
His is separate.
Okay, so
His is the he has to take to the wildlife or to the racks and or the rack and wildlife boards native species introductions, and that's all that would be.
Okay, so we'll just continue on with this one then. Do we have any other questions from board members? Questions from the rack chairs? Questions from the audience? If you do, will you come up to this mic that's on the north end? No questions from the audience? Okay, so we will go to rack chairs on what happened at their rack that night. We'll start with the southern region, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The southern region made a motion to accept the fishing guidebook and rule R657-13 as presented by the division, with the exception to include trout in the removal of the possession limit once they are at the permanent domicile. And then in an attempt to further define domicile, they added where a person votes in the definition. And that was voted upon unanimously.
Okay, Kevin?
Yeah, the southeastern region didn't have a majority vote. We're going to have to find some more rack members that aren't such outdoorsmen and have CWMUs and such. It's really a conflict in September. No, all kidding aside, I did try to do my best to have to get everyone's input so that it would give you as the board an idea of what they were thinking, and I think it's very safe to say that they were very much supportive of the division's recommendation.
Okay, so no motion made there. Wayne?
Northeast region was to support the division's plan with an exception, which we include what the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife had proposed. They feel the issue of the trout limit was on the unlimited side. I didn't have the summary motion, but this was the motion. Motion passed 5-3.
Okay. Gary from the Central Region.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. We had quite a bit of discussion about the keeping a fish in the freezer and why it shouldn't or couldn't apply to trout. And as it ultimately turned out with the recommendations from Drew, that would be revisited in the following year and or the next time we went through it, and that would be looked at further. They wanted to see what the effect was on the warm water. Anyway, at that point, the motion was presented to accept as the division had proposed it, and it passed unanimously.
Robert, Northern Region.
Robert, I can't hear you.
On? Borrow. Louder.
How about now?
Cool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motion from the Northern Region was to recommend the Wildlife Board approve Fishing Guidebook and Rule R657-13 as presented. It passed 8 in favor, 1 opposed.
Okay. I have a few comment cards here. I have three, so if anybody else wants to fill one out, why they need to do so. First one will be Lee Tracy, followed by Paul Dremmen.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. United Wildlife Cooperative supports the recommendations of the Division of Wildlife Resources regarding particularly the possession of a fish in the freezer. Thank you.
Paul will be followed by Ken Strong.
Hey, my name is Paul Draymond. I'm the chairman of the Utah Anglers Coalition and also Sport Fish representative on the Fish Health Policy Board. Our organization includes most major angling organizations, both bass, trout, walleye, and a representative from SFW. We do have one guideline that says that an individual organization can take a position different from the Anglers Coalition as a whole. One of our purposes is to support and coordinate those efforts by member organizations that enhance our aquatic resources and promote conservation. We spent considerable time with Division Aquatic Section going over the proposed regulation changes, and with the exception of the home possession limit, we unanimously support the division's recommendation and appreciate the approach they're taking with regard for spear fishing. With the respect to the no possession limit, we did have a significant majority that did support the division's position. We have one further recommendation, and that is that for any recommendations that may come before the board that have not gone through this rigorous procedure of public and biological review prior to coming here, we recommend that those undergo a subsequent evaluation before the board formally addresses that issue. Thank you very much.
Question while you're right there.
Yes, sir.
That last comment that you just made, give me a little more information. Well,
yeah, basically, what I'm saying is that the division has spends a great deal of time with the public, with the RAC system, with review meetings or whatever, going over the recommendations, input from their biologists in the regions. And it's a very good, rigorous rigorous process. At times, somebody with a very good idea may come before the board with a recommendation different or in addition to what the division's gone through, and it may be an excellent idea, but what we're basically saying is that that idea subsequently goes through the same process in that has taken place on what formerly has presented to you. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, somewhat, I think. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Ken Strong?
Ken Strong, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and I'd like to thank the board for the opportunity I have to address you at this time. Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife approves all of the proposals that have come forth from the division, with the exception that we would like to add trout to the no limit once they hit your primary domicile. I know the division has worries about otter, creek, and pang, which has been mentioned today. However, if people want to go there and camp 2 or 3 weeks in their trailer, that's fine, but they're still only entitled to a 2-day possession limit. It's not a primary domicile. A trailer isn't. A cabin isn't. There's no way that they can do that. And if they come from out of state, they have to live in the state for 6 months before they can buy a resident fishing license, and therefore anyone that lives in the state of Utah that comes from out of state, they don't have a situation where they can vote or anything for 6 months. So that, again, people camping in trailers and cabins, that wouldn't include. One of the things that the division has asked for on the Oak Creek Reservoir on the boulders is a 16-fish limit on the brook trout. Now, if you go to the boulders and you stay 2 days, that gives you 32 fish you're entitled to. And they want you to do this because there is too many brook trout in Oak Creek Reservoir. However, once you go home, you can't go fishing again until, legally for trout, until you get down below 8 fish. So you're, in a way, you're penalized for going out and helping the division, and then you can't go fishing again until you've consumed those fish. Another big concern was, another thing is that if you go to Strawberry or Flaming Gorge under the current law and the proposal, you go to Strawberry and you catch 4 fish and you come home and your neighbor says, let's go to Deer Creek, they're catching monsters up there as fast as you can pull them out. You can't do it until you've consumed those 4 fish or fish that you've caught at Strawberry the previous day, because they count on your limit, and you're in Strawberry or Flaming Gorge, you have a 4-fish limit, and that's it. So that's why we're pushing to have the primary domicile rule And it also, where all fish are off your limit when you get home, and it also makes things simpler. We need to keep things simple. And fishing, it is kind of complicated in the way that each lake and stream basically has their own rules, and it's needed. It's needed for those reservoirs and those streams because of the different things that go on. But we need to have make things as simple as we can. You know, people have been bottling fish and freezing fish forever. One of the things I've noticed as I've gone around is a lot of people have no idea what the law really means, and they thought that once they got the fish home, they no longer counted on their limit. And they do, survey that they did, the majority of the people, though it was a slight majority, wanted the fish taken off your limit once you got home. And it's a law that's basically really hard to enforce. In the last 20 to 30 years, it's been enforced maybe 3 times. It's basically really hard to enforce, and so therefore, it's not going to. I don't think there's going to be that much of a change. People are already doing it, and we want to increase the fishing in this great state. And I think this is one of the ways we can do it. In about the mid 1990s, there was 515,000 fishing licenses sold. Last year, there was about 485,000 fishing licenses sold, and we're climbing up again. But we need to entice these people to buy licenses, make things simpler for them, make it so it's worth their time to go out and fishing, and so therefore, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife would like you to consider putting all fish off your limit once they hit your primary domicile. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Kent. Tim Corner? That's the last card I have.
I'm Jim Carter, and I represent the Strawberry Anglers Association. Our association is a member of the Utah Anglers Coalition, and we do agree with the Utah Anglers Coalition position. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was when we dealt with the Strawberry Reservoir, when it was poisoned, the public and the anglers worked together hand in hand with the biologist and the wildlife resources scientist. And we spent time educating the public about what we were doing at Strawberry and why. And we did this for a couple of years. Then it came forward to where it was put into position. As Paul Draymond recommended earlier, that when an idea comes up, if we have time to study it, if we have time to evaluate it, then we get the groups all working together, and we come up with a good project. If we look at what has happened at the Strawberry Reservoir following this procedure, and with your help, you can see that if we take the time to evaluate, should we add trout to the non-limit in your freezer, what would be the impacts, especially on some of the key waters in the state that brings people from all over the world? We need to find that out. We need to investigate it. So what the wildlife resources biologists are suggesting, we strongly support. And we think that we need to look at that thoroughly before the final decision is made here at the board. Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes all our comment cards. I'm going to summarize the RAC motions and how they voted. The Southern Region and the Northeastern Region voted to pass the fishing guidebook rule as presented, with the exception of on a trout issue, where they'd be able to keep more, be able to go fishing and keep more in their freezer or whatnot, as Ken presented. The central region and the northern region voted unanimous and 8-1 to approve the guidebook rule as presented by the division. And the southern region didn't have a quorum, so, or southeastern, thanks. Didn't have a quorum, so no motions were made. So, Greg, do you have a little summary you want to give us there?
Yeah, first off, do board members have any questions on the definition of permanent residence that we have in our rule and how it might apply to different situations? I can try to explain some of the concerns that Drew mentioned earlier in his presentation.
Can I ask three questions?
Definitely.
And it doesn't have to do with the residence, but it does have to do with possession. Processed fish count if you bottle the fish that you catch and you stick them on your shelf or in your freezer or wherever you're going to store them? Do those fish count as part of the limit?
Yes.
Okay. Does a cooked fish count?
Unless
if I go home and I cook all 16 of my brook trout, but I don't eat them all, and I stick them in the fridge, do they count?
You're still in possession. Technically, yes, although I'd have to say that a portion of this might be subject to conservation officer discretion and how they apply rules in particular situations. So technically, yes, if you're in possession of fish, whether cooked or not, it would still qualify as possession.
Okay, and then my last question is, does having a possession or a limit of fish in possession prevent me from going out and doing catch and release fishing?
Yes. And maybe Rick, would you like to weigh in on that? It wouldn't count unless you kept the fish after you so if you mortally wound a fish and you keep it in your possession, then that situation would qualify. But catch and release, no.
Okay, if I catch four fish and I stick four fish in my creel, do I have to stop?
No.
Okay.
I have a question following up on Mike's. My son and I both fish. So do we have to keep our fish separate in the freezer of which ones he caught versus which ones I caught?
Rick, you want to come up here?
Hey, my name's Rick Holtz, and I'm a captain in the law enforcement section, and I just want to clarify a lot of the rumor that's out there. We do not just go knock on doors and say, freezer check. There's only two ways we can legally get into a freezer. That is consent by the homeowner or with a warrant signed by a judge. The only time we do that is when we get a call from the public with a complaint that an individual is taking over the daily limit. Usually that in relation to what we call double tripping or triple tripping, where they take a limit, take them home, go back the same day, take another limit, take it home. It's the smart guys trying to get around the daily limits. When that happens, we'll do an investigation, get a search warrant. When we get into those freezers, we usually find gross over limits, up to 100 fish sometimes. But as Drew mentioned, that only happens once or twice a year at the most. So, and our officers, while it may be technically illegal, technically you have to count that cooked fish as part of your limit, we do not, as an officer, count those cooked fish. We could, but we don't.
Greg, talking about your primary domicile.
Okay.
So there was some discussion in the southern region on how you voted, or
yeah.
You want to give us some clarification on
So in drafting the definition that you see here of permanent residence, there were really three objectives we were trying to accomplish. One was to eliminate those temporary forms of storage, whether that be in a cooler or a trailer. Second was to make sure that there was only one permanent location that an individual could store fish at, and that was clear under the rule. Then third was to clarify for both anglers and law enforcement where that location is, whether it be a fixed address or a clear definition of what that location looks like. In using the reference to residency that's found in the Wildlife Code, it gave law enforcement the tool of using an address, whether that be in our licensing database or on the angler's license, as a very clear, bright-line rule of where that storage could take place. However, if you look at the definition of residency in the Wildlife Code, an individual has to be domiciled in the state for 6 continuous months before they can claim residency status. So we leave out a portion of the angling community. If they come from out of state, purchase a home within Utah, and live there for 5.5 months, they would not be able to store fish at that location under this definition of permanent residence. They would be over that limit. So in looking at our options and the idea of maybe using voter registration as an element, if you look at the Wildlife Code, there's also a definition of domicile, and it's very clear, very complete. And if we used that reference instead of the reference to residency, a conservation officer and an angler could use other forms to prove where that location is, whether that be voter registration, driver's license, where they have their utility bills sent. That there would still be a mechanism for law enforcement to ensure that there's only one location and it's a permanent location where that storage is taking place, and it might not limit an individual to where their voter registration card says they claim their domicile if that changes. So that just for your consideration, I would be hesitant to limit the definition of domicile if you intend to go that way, and you wish to allow non-residents that have moved to the state recently to store fish at their home.
So in your second comments there, you talked about a secondary of what domicile meant or whatever?
Yeah, it's within the definition section of the Wildlife Code.
Okay.
And so if we modified this proposed definition to be permanent residence means, for the purposes of this rule only, the domicile that an individual claims pursuant to Utah Code 2313-2-213, which means... Domicile means where an individual has a fixed permanent home and principal establishment to which the individual, if absent, intends to return, and in which the individual and the individual's family voluntarily reside, not for a special or temporary purpose, but with the intention of making a permanent home. There's also a definitional section that allows an individual to change a domicile, but it is a singular permanent location.
Any other questions? Thank you.
I do have one question. I don't know who to address this to. If I'm an out-of-state resident and I come in and buy an out-of-state fishing license, is it a 365-day? Is it? Can I get a 365-day fishing license? Okay, so it's the same, going to get a multi-year fishing license out of state. So it's the same regs. You don't have to buy you're limited to a 14-day or limited to a certain number of days. It's the same as a resident.
Yes, same structure.
Different fees?
More expensive.
More expensive. But the structure is the same. You can get multi-year, but you do have to prove that you're out of state?
You have to attest to that.
Do I have to provide identification? to get that, or just say, hey, this is, I'm John Doe and I live here.
People, non-residents, the issue is usually they're claiming the residency, not the non-residency. So.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's the same document type.
Okay, so it can be a one-year or a multi-year non-resident fishing license.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so I have a question from Gary. Put you on the spot, because you already mentioned it anyway. But in your central region RAC, were they going to vote in favor of the trout limitation thing until it was brought up that they would study it in two more years? Does that make sense?
You know, we have quite a few fishing coalition guys, one of them on the board, and they were strongly opposed to it, as they are here today, for the reasons they mentioned. Felt like it hadn't been studied enough, but it did go through every RAC process, and a lot of the RACs were for it. A lot of the people, yeah, I was thinking that there was a good chance that it would make it.
Okay. But it never did actually come up for a vote that way, though.
No.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we've pretty much got a split quorum on the RAC.
Got one more question for Kevin. You didn't have a quorum, but I read in the minutes that you went, you know, person by person, what are your thoughts, and they were generally in favor of the division's proposal. Was there much discussion on the trout proposal? Did they weigh in on that? I'm not sure I read and understood that right, but give me a brief update on the trout portion of it.
So there was the discussion with SFW that come and give some discussion on their proposal. There was a little bit of discussion from the RAC members that acknowledged the proposal from SFW, but even with that difference in proposal from the divisions, it was pretty clear that the public or that the RAC wanted to go with the division's proposal.
But by not including the trout, though. Okay.
Follow up, Mike?
I was just going to say I was at that meeting, and that's the impression that I got from hearing that discussion, is that they were pretty much in support of DWRs.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we did have, early in the meeting, one of the RAC members proposed, you know, early on before we'd even discussed the trout issue and how it was going to affect people, and he proposed it to present it as it was presented, or to, you know, put it up as a motion, and it didn't get a second. So then we further discussed it, and then after the talking about looking at it carefully later to see what the impact was going to be, then it did pass.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. Okay. We are to a board discussion and motion, and maybe a possible vote. I think there was some very good ideas brought forth on this. I think Ken made a good case for why it needs to maybe move in a different direction. But I also feel pretty good about Drew and them being up front and saying they'd reevaluate it in 2 years with looking at what happens on some of the other waters. So,
I have a comment on the Strawberry Angler's comment about, you know, more time to discuss this, to study it, and was it the Fishing Coalition? The group, okay, and that they said the same, but I to an extent, I think the division has looked at it. You know, it may not have been as, well, I actually think it probably was as in-depth. They just chose not to bring that up. So I think maybe they have discussed it, and they're just a little bit against it right now. But I think it has been, had received some study.
Well, and it hasn't received any study with any results.
They've discussed it, but they want a more in-depth, concrete study on it.
And that's what Drew brought up, is that they would do some study on these waters for 2 years and then reevaluate what happened there in the next two-year period, 2016. That's why I questioned him if he'd be committed to that. So,
me personally, I can see both sides of this issue. I I don't want to be violating any rules if I have 9 trout in my freezer and I should only have 8. But that I would guess that there are a lot of folks that don't think about that. I would think that even though that's probably stated pretty clearly in guidebooks and websites and every place else, that it's like a lot of people out there, they just don't pay attention to that and they just do what they want to do. And there are obviously a lot of folks that are very conscientious about that, but there are a lot of folks that just don't pay any attention to it. And so I think there's some things that ultimately need to be resolved there. We've heard our division law enforcement folks say they're not looking the other way necessarily, but they're not really going out and looking for folks that are in violation of that. And I think that's kind of an awkward position to be in. I think there's a law we ought to, or a regulation, we ought to enforce it the best that we can. So I think it does ultimately need to be resolved, but I do think it's important to get a handle, especially if those southern region folks are concerned enough about it that they're making the proposal to keep it out of the trout, out of that for a period of time so that they can study it and see what's going on. They may very well find that it's not having any effect at all, but I don't think you can make that judgment without actually looking at things. So I personally would make a motion that we accept the division's recommendations as proposed.
Okay, so we have a motion by Mike to accept the division's recommendation and rule R657-13 as presented. Do you have a second?
I'll second that.
We have a second by Calvin. Any other discussion?
Do you want to keep these two items split? Do you want to...
Oh, he made a motion as presented.
Okay, as presented. I seconded that because I agree with your comments and about the possession. It makes sense to do that. With the adding the trout, I don't know whether to amend the motion and add the trout or whether to address that as a separate issue.
You seconded his motion as presented, so.
Okay, but we could still come back though and. Add a motion.
No, you'd be done.
Okay.
This passes.
Then with that second, I will amend the motion then to add the trout to the possession limit, as been discussed, as an amendment to the motion.
I'll second that.
And I'm confused.
Okay, we got a motion to accept.
And it is. And
that's all right, but I can still amend the motion though. I can still amend that to add to it because I agree with the motion. We need to
on the amended motion.
Yeah, now we have a motion with an amendment.
I'm not that confused, but I was wondering why you did that.
Give you time.
Okay, I agree with the motion that we need to accept the division, but I would like to add the trout into it.
So what was his vote at the legislature? Okay, we have a motion to amend.
These are Robert's Rules of Order executive here.
We had
you stay here. Are we doing? Tell us if we're not doing this right.
Motion again.
Okay, there's a motion to accept the division and an amendment to the motion to add trout to the motion.
Which is
that we add trout to your possession limits.
Okay.
To the no limit once you get back to your domicile.
Okay. And Steve seconded that. Am I correct?
Right. The reason being... if I can comment a little bit, Bill's comment just really hit home with me. Who's to say who put those fish in the freezer? I didn't know he put 12 fish in the freezer. Those aren't mine. You know, you can have a freezer there that's got 6 different people's fish in that freezer. So essentially what you're ending up with is an unenforceable rule here, a law that really shouldn't be on the books, in my opinion. And
I agree with his thinking too. We also fish in Wyoming a lot.
Sure.
And bring home. Now do I have to keep? Well, these are the Wyoming fish. These are the Utah fish.
Yeah, you got to label your package. These came from Oak Creek Reservoir, and these came from Fontanelle. And these are so and so's, and these are somebody else's. That's the whole scenario that just seems completely unenforceable to me.
I agree, which is why I seconded the motion that we need to make the change there. But I would like to add the trout to the no possession limit. Yeah, okay, I don't know that that would. I really don't think you're going to overfish a trout population in a reservoir by adding a few more fish.
So we have a motion on the amendment to include trout. And I'm going to call for a vote on that. All in favor? Three. Those against? One. So that carries. And then we have a motion to approve the remainder of the fishing guidebook and rule as presented. All in favor of that? Motion carries.
Yes, I am.
Okay. That gets us through that. We have 25 minutes until lunchtime. We're going to go to Richard Hepworth with item 6, Native Cutthroat. When it gets noon, we're going to lunch.
Thank you, and I'll make sure you're done by noon. Hey, I'm Richard Hepworth. I'm the aquatics manager down in the southern region. Part of our program down there includes preserving, protecting, enhancing native fish populations. Specifically, and in this first slide, we're talking about some of our cutthroat trout populations. Based on rule code, we have to come to you guys and get approval to put these into any new locations where they're not currently at. Prior to coming here and the RACs, we went around to every one of the county commissions and visited with them to make sure they were supportive or at least not against any of these. Some of the counties didn't want to come out and say we support it, but they didn't come out and say we were against it either. So, but we have sat down and talked with them. These list of waters you see here are kind of our plan for up to about the next 10 years. Some of the restoration projects we'll be doing within the southern region. This first list is mainly our Bonneville cutthroat trout populations. The second page has some southern leatherside. They're a leatherside chub that are a native fish in the Sevier River drainage. And then the Colorado River cutthroat trout and some bluehead suckers as well. So I don't know. I wasn't going to go through each one of these individually unless you guys have any questions on that. And that's really what I had.
You guys have any questions from Richard?
You talk about time frames and kind of what a plan might look like moving forward on these species.
Yeah, I can do that. Before any of these happen, we put together a plan for the stream or system. I'll use Calf Creek here, the last one, as an example. We've been talking with the BLM. This is out on the Grand Staircase in between Escalante and Boulder. We've been talking with the BLM. They're supportive and doing this. But we'll put together a plan. We'll sit down again with county commissioners. We'll sit down with local communities. We'll talk with anglers and make sure there isn't any real controversy or problems prior to doing this. Work out all those before we ever get there. This one we've been talking about. If I had to put a date on before something would happen there, we're looking at probably 6 to 7 years down the road before we'd really start on the ground work because of all the legwork and the discussions we have with our different constituents, different agencies, and different publics out there. Does that answer kind of what you were looking for there? And we'll do that for each one of these locations prior to moving forward.
So all these locations, you're that far out on all of them?
The first page, Clear Creek, Mill Creek, that one's an interesting one. That one we came to the Wildlife Board approximately 8 or 9 years ago and had that one on this list. We had a fire there that sped that way up, and we were able to get in there and do some of the work we needed to do to remove some of the non-native fish. And we expanded that project based on that fire from when we originally come to the Wildlife Board to get approval. That's why we decided let's go ahead and make sure that The lower end of this, which was not included in the original proposal, is in today's proposal. So this one, once we get approval, it'll pretty much be completed, that we're that far along on the Clear Creek Mill Creek project. The rest of them on this page, all we've been in is talks, doing some surveys, looking to see if these are possible to even do. But a lot of them won't, we won't get to them from anywhere from Mammoth Creek. We may be starting in 2 to 3 years, because we've got others that we're still trying to finish up from the last time we came and talked to you, up to possibly a 10-year plan.
So it takes a while
to get through all the hoops and hurdles to make sure our public isn't against it. We don't want to be out there doing a lot of things that they don't want us doing.
You just want to make sure you're doing the right thing in the right place for the right reasons before you throw a non-native in there, and then all of a sudden, holy smokes, I think we messed up here.
Exactly.
Okay.
Does the creeks that you would do this, like the Calf Creek, for example, then you would no longer stock other trout? It would only be natives be allowed and be in streams where they can reproduce, as opposed to continue and have to bring back and add more to the population?
What would happen on Calf Creek, for example, is once we've gone through the public process, then we'd go in and do a rote-known treatment on that stream to remove a wild brown trout fishery that's in there. We'd get rid of all the brown trout, and then we'd go back in and stock the cutthroat trout. Generally, and the streams we pick to do this on are ones where we go in and stock 2 to 3 times to establish an initial population, and then they reproduce on their own, and we don't have to ever go back and augment those populations in any way. Calf Creek would be Colorado River cutthroat, but some of the list is Bonneville, and then the one on there for Colorado would be Calf Creek.
I was just going to ask what the source of your suckers are.
They'll come out of the Escalante River, right downstream of there. Some are already in Calf Creek, and when we do the work in there, we'll probably salvage some that are already there as well.
I know they're catching a lot of those out of places in the southeast region right now and using those in the southeast region, but you're using fish from your side of the...
Yeah, we try and use the closest source or the nearest neighbor idea in a lot of cases.
On that Mammoth Creek project there, you're dealing with a lot of people who have secondary homes. A lot of Las Vegas people, for example, are bought homes with different things in there. So how do you treat those different people who have residences from in-state, out-state?
With the Mammoth Creek area, they have a homeowners association. And I'm glad you asked me about that one, because we just recently had a meeting and went to their homeowners association meeting. Now, we don't get everybody that way, and talk to them about this specific project. Now the specific project is going to be upstream or above that mainly private community there as well. But we just explain it, talk to them. And a lot of times when we go do that, we'll go talk to them and we leave thinking, oh, this is good and wonderful. And everybody goes home, thinks about it some more. And then we have a lot of questions and we end up going back 2 or 3 times and talking to them. And then the word spreads from that as well, and we start getting phone calls. But we do everything we can to reach as many of those people in those communities as we can as well.
Okay, any other questions? You have any questions from any of the RAC chairs? Have any questions from the audience? Okay, so this one was heard by the southern region only. Dave?
Mr. Chairman, southern region voted unanimous to accept native cutthroat trout new introductions as presented by the division.
I don't have any comment cards, so to summarize, the meeting in Richfield, we had a pretty good turnout there. I thought we'd be home by 8:30, and it was after 10. So kind of excited to see that many people out, and there was a lot of people from some other counties there too. So anyway, Southern Rock voted to approve as presented by the division. A word to board discussion and motion.
I just have a question. I'm assuming this is the case, but it doesn't say anything about the suckers in that motion that we have. It just says native cutthroat trout. So I'm guessing that the suckers are part of that.
Well, the second part of that is they approved it as presented by the division. The whole motion. So it should be covered in there.
It's got the leather side too. So all those fish species.
Well, with that, I'm looking for a motion, Steve.
A motion to accept the presentation division just made.
Okay, so we have a motion by Steve. Second by Mike. Any other discussion? All in favor? Motion passes. Thanks, Richard. Okay. It is 11:45. Are we good for lunch?
Yeah.
Okay. We're breaking for lunch. We'll be back approximately 12:45. I hope Drew went to the lake. Okay, we're ready to go. Item 7, conservation permit annual report. Mr. Bates.
Well, I'm glad I got here just in time.
Yep.
Just like to make a couple of comments before we start. Just a brief update on the crow hunt. We do know that we had one crow harvested so far this year. It was shot by somebody with an apple tree over in the Roosevelt area. And we know of several people who went out and tried to harvest some crows, and they found it was much more difficult than they thought and were not able to harvest any, but they did succeed in chasing them around the forest. So,
was the one they got, was it a crow?
It was. Well, that beak was probably... And just to clarify a little bit about Justin's report on the mountain goat study group down on the LaSalle's, he said that it went well. That's kind of a... There were actually mixed reviews on that one. It seems that there's some down there that are intent on removing the goats, but we're going to work with the Forest Service to make sure that they look at scientifically valid data, and we've agreed to work with them if there are real problems. But so far, we haven't found any with our monitoring. So, anyway,
most of
those
folks were here at the meeting and were in opposition last year when the board approved that. So. There aren't lots of them, I think. So,
no.
But there are a few.
There were a couple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, real quickly, just talk about this last year's conservation permit program as part of our audit and requirements that the board become in every year and report on the conservation permit program. Just like to briefly go through Conservation Permits 101, and the program was first offered in 1981. It was based on the governor's permits that were being issued in Nevada and Arizona at the time. And that the first year we had one bighorn sheep permit that was sold to Fred Morris for $20,000. And as far as I can tell, in 1983 was the first year we extended that to bison and moose. The purpose of the conservation permit program is to provide permits for conservation groups to sell at auctions. The funds are to be used for wildlife conservation projects, and they should be spent on the species from which they were derived. Funds are to be divided as follows: 10% retained by the conservation group for administrative needs, 30% is given to the division as internal conservation permit funds, and 60% can be retained by the conservation groups to be spent on programs that they approve. And that also requires the approval of the division as well. The species that are available for deer, elk, pronghorn, moose, bison, Rocky Mountain and Desert Bighorn Sheep, mountain goat, turkey, cougar, and black bear. We have statewide permits. There's one permit per species. It's available for all open units. The season dates, you can see, basically start September 1st, unless it begins on a Sunday, and then we can change that. Area conservation permits are valid for a specific unit or combination of units. They're restricted to a specific weapon type, whereas the statewide permit can hunt all three seasons, and it's valid for the same season dates as a public draw permit with some exceptions. So how are permits allocated? We allocate about 5% of the total limit entry and once-in-a-lifetime permits. For instance, this year we have about 6,500 permits. We have recommended 300, or actually the board has already authorized 317 permits as area conservation permits, and so that is about 4.8%. And that's based on the formula and rule, and due to rounding, you know, it might be 5.1, you know, like down to 4.8, but that's basically where it'll be. But there is a maximum of 8 permits per hunt type, so that will probably always keep it below the 5%. And area conservation permits are deducted from public permits. The multi-year permits are available to conservation groups with a proven track record. Over time, they must have generated at least 1% of total conservation permit funds in the previous 3 years. Each group is ranked based on their performance and how much they feel that they can raise, and then groups conduct a draft using available credits. We give them credits based on their performance, and then permits are issued for 3 years, but we can adjust those if we have permit, if the public permits decline. We also have single-year permits. You have to be a 501c3 group. The permits are based on the value of the permits plus the performance of the group, and you must have at least a 70% performance rating over the last 2 years. So here's the allocation for this year, and I don't expect us to take the time to go through this cell by cell, but we had 317 permits. Most of the permits are for bull elk, but there's quite a few buck deer permits as well. And yeah, anyway, you can take a look at that. Here's a graph that shows the amount of money generated from 2001 to 2014. As you can see, we've hit a high this last year with about $3.46 million, which was a really great year. This pie chart shows you the breakdown by group. It gives you kind of shows you how much they were, you know, they raised in proportion to the total amount. How are the funds used? We use them for transplants. This last year we transplanted mountain goats, bighorn sheep. Didn't do any moose this year, but we have in the past. We also moved about 200 deer, turkeys, and we have moved bison in the past, although we didn't this last year. This year we used quite a bit of the money for our wildlife surveys. It's very costly to do these surveys, but the data we're generating right now really helps with the helps us make scientifically based recommendations. We also do our telemetry flights. We pay for some of those with conservation permits. We have quite a research and monitoring budget that we've used conservation permits in conjunction with PR funds. You might be aware this last year we had a tremendous increase in the amount of money available through the Pittman-Robertson Act, the 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition. And so we took that money to leverage with conservation permits to fund our research for the next 4 years. What we did is we've got these studies set up, and it'll actually help us a lot with our managements, particularly with the elk. Elk, moose, and deer, you know, all of them. This year we're going to start an elk movement study where we look at the interaction of elk in the different units, and that will help you make your decisions in the future. Habitat enhancement. This last year we allocated $1.6 million. Well, actually, we allocated $1.3 million of new money, but we actually spent $1.61 million of conservation permit funds on habitat projects. We did use an additional $300,000 from our internal conservation permit funds. That's the $300,000 that comes back to the division. Here's an example of some of the projects we've committed money to for this last year. So that was a quick run-through. I just would like to mention that there is no way that the Division of Wildlife Resources could have the aggressive transplant research, monitoring and habitat programs that we have without these conservation permits. They actually help us to be able to do those extra things to help us manage wildlife more effectively. And so that's my report. So thanks.
You guys got any questions from Bill while he's up there?
Bill, on that last figure you showed, $300,000, that's the money that comes back to you from the conservation groups?
Right, the 30% they give back to the division.
Mm-hmm. Nat, that's dedicated specifically to go to anything besides these huntable species?
That's a good question. We specifically target a species, but the benefit is to many species.
But you don't take money from that to work on rare frogs?
No, we don't. There may be habitat. We do a lot of riparian works, particularly in the southeastern region where we're removing tamarisk, and planting with willows and things that would benefit those kind of species. So I would say that they are not, that there are benefits to those species, but what we do is we target.
Indirect.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because the way the rule's written, we need to target those species. So.
Bill, you said 60% is retained by the conservation group for projects that they decide on what they want to do. Is that a collaboration with the division and an agreement on this project, as opposed to they want to do one, you'd rather them not do it?
Yeah, let me tell you how this works. Is in April, and I would invite all of you to come to this meeting last year on April 1st. I mean, no kidding, it was on April Fool's Day, and so I could have thought that I couldn't have believed what happened that day. But the groups came, we met in this room, and they committed $1.6 million to projects that we proposed. And it was just like a feeding frenzy, everybody was so excited with a lot of the great projects that our agency and other agencies have put forth. I mean, it was great to be part of that synergistic process. So,
is it always projects that you propose, or can they come forward with something that they have a certain passion for? And I guess either way works, as long as you both work it out together.
They have other projects that they propose, but they still have to be approved by our director, and I'm a signatory on all those as well. So they have to have a demonstrated value to the species, to wildlife conservation in Utah. But, yeah, they come up with many projects.
And there you say, hey, you know what, sounds good to us, go for it.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, maybe some of those representatives from some of those groups will come up and comment, and if they do, you can ask those kind of questions to them as well.
Any other questions? Any of the rack chairs got any questions? Any questions from the audience? Okay. I don't have any comment cards. Over to board discussion and a motion to approve the report.
I just want to make a comment on this conservation permit program. It looks like a win-win for everybody. Let's keep it going. I'd make a motion that we accept the presentation that Bill just made.
I'll second that.
Second by Calvin. All in favor? Motion carries. Next one will be conservation permit audit report. Kenny Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's up really quick. Thanks again. Thanks, board members, RAC chairs, members of the public. Kenny Johnson, I'm the admin services chief here in Salt Lake City, and our team, before we get too much into the audit, it's a big undertaking, small army of people to kind of keep track of the funds and audit this program every year. And so really quick, wanted to thank our internal staff, Sarah Scott, who helps a lot with this, Anita Candelaria does a lot with it, Mike and Tyler and Nathan. So it's a team here to kind of to keep track of this and make sure it's heading in the right direction. So thanks, guys. So really quick, we did perform an audit. The program, again, Bill kind of touched on a lot of this stuff, so we'll move pretty quick, and it's a short presentation anyway. But again, small fraction of general permits are awarded to our conservation partners, and then they bring us the critical work on the ground and critical funds to do some things to move the mission forward and protect wildlife. And so this year, 317 permits were awarded to the groups. These are the permits, it's probably important to note, that are different than the convention. This is conservation, and those two sometimes get mixed up. These are conservation permits, and they're marketed by these groups that are kind of more specialized in that area and auctioned off to high bid. The revenue, as Bill mentioned, is kind of just returned the way he already talked about. 30% direct to the division, that's due on September 1st. 60% retained for the group for division approved projects, and then the groups get to keep a fraction, 10% of it to kind of help move their mission forward and cover their overhead and administrative costs. What the audit does, essentially, it ensures three things. It makes sure that expenditures for projects were approved by the division before the work starts, that the funds are kept separate and insured bank accounts and institutions, and that the permit prices that get reported at a banquet actually match when they come back in to the division in check form. And so that's the three key components of the audit. This year, findings, recommendations, 100% compliance with the monthly bank statement provision that we put in place last year. I don't know if we need to go over that too much, but last year we had the groups provide us a bank statement for every month, and they willingly complied with that, no problems at all this year. And again, probably worth mentioning, some of the groups are here today. They're really great for our staff to work with and keep meticulous records, and it makes this process a lot easier to work through. Second bullet down, 100% compliance on funds kept separate and in secure bank accounts, no issues there. 110 permits were kind of selected randomly and by banquets we could get DWR staff to capture a price out at the banquet and then look at that when it comes back in, and there were no compliance issues with any of those permits this year. We did find that one project, a small project, I believe getting water to some guzzlers wasn't approved prior to work starting, and so one of our main recommendations is that we just make sure that these groups follow that protocol and follow the process and get those projects approved prior to any work starting for this year. And then everybody, I think, in the packet had a copy of the executive summary, and so this is just kind of the overall picture of how it went. And I don't know if we need to spend a lot of time on this one. Kind of gives you the totals of permits down the sides, the 2014 funds that were available this year, that's the 60% that Bill talked about. And you can see that those totals by group, and then down at the bottom it's totaled again in total conservation permit money. The next column over is just the carryover funds from the last year, and then a total of those two columns to give us all the available funds from 12 to 14, and then actual funds spent on the approved projects, and that's again the total Bill had mentioned in his presentation, that 1.6. And then what we do is we make sure that balance at the end there, that required fund balance in the audit, matches what the bank statements say, and that's a big part of what we do, and everything looked fine there. We added that last column, the FY 2015 committed project funds, just to kind of complete the picture. We're actually preparing invoices now for the first part of 2015 that have additional funds that we're already billing them for, and so some of the balances, we just want to make sure that it actually reflected what's really happening. We look at a specific point in time with the audit, and then we're a few months outside of that with some of these new invoices. And so we're actually, the point kind of is we're going through these monies and spending them on worthwhile things. That's really the audit for this year. That's
All I have.
Can we look at that chart again that you just had up? Using mule deer as one example, the Mule Deer Foundation, it shows carryover funds of $981,000, and then available funds from 2012 to 2014 is $1.5 million. Is that continue to grow from carryover funds?
It does. So that 1.5 is both the 14, the new funds, and the carryover from the previous year.
And so the money they have, it doesn't have to be spent in a given year, then they can carry it over.
It can carry over to a point. It has to be expended or committed to projects within 3 years.
Okay.
So I think a summary looking at this, Kenny, would be that looking at the bottom right boxes, there's $3 million in the bank, if you will, $1.3 million roughly, that's committed. So there'd be about $1.7, $1.8 million that's available to be committed, probably mostly when we have our big project day in April. Is that right? Mike Canning, or you, or whomever? Is that accurate? So that's kind of what they'll have available to them as we come into next April, when we have a day where we offer a lot of projects that they could commit to. And
Projects either already in the works or approved in the future, yeah.
And typically we'd have, you know, several million dollars of available projects, and then these groups can channel those dollars towards projects they feel like support the mission of their organization.
Any other questions? Steve?
And then these funds also generate other funds that attach to them for projects that are implemented, correct?
Yeah. You know, these are key because this counts as state money. And when we get contracts from, say, BLM or Forest Service or others, as we work on some of these larger ranging watershed restoration projects, these are key dollars that help do that sort of work. And as also mentioned, the research we do a fair amount of, and transplants and those sorts of things, those go right on the ground. So this is a great program. These are great dollars. I wish we had a few more of them to work with, because they give us a lot of latitude to do good stuff for wildlife.
Any other questions from Kenny from the board? Back chairs, you got any questions? Any questions from the audience? Oh,
Jake?
Robert?
I'm assuming that your fiscal year is running the same as the state fiscal year then. Is that correct?
This is more deadline driven on September 1. So it's a month or two past the fiscal year. Or state's July to June 30th.
The reason for that is our rule allows these organizations to sell these permits and get the money to us till September 1st. So we want to make sure they have a full banquet season, if you will, to get all those done, and then give us a little bit of time to prepare this report that's done internally before this meeting. So they've done a great job getting this early. I used to do this a while back, and I never had it done this soon. Did I, Stacy? Never.
It's always kind of been that December.
I was gone hunting in the fall. I wasn't doing audit.
We still hunt.
Any questions from the public? No comment cards? Okay. Any other discussion from the board before you make a motion to approve?
The only question or comment I would have is, let us know between you and Bill when you're having that meeting in April. That'd be interesting to attend to see what goes on. And
absolutely.
That'd be great. If you just quick email to us and let us know, that'd be awesome. Thanks.
Before we go to a motion, Director probably reminded me it'd be a good time to maybe hear a report from a couple of the groups that are here in attendance on some of these conservation permit funding and what they've done with it. So start with you and then Byron, if you want to afterwards. Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, other board members, I'm Eric Tixon. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Mule Deer Foundation. And I know I can speak on behalf, I won't, but I can, of the rest of the conservation groups and tell you that as sportsmen in the state of Utah, we're proud to be a part of this program. It empowers our members and our volunteers as well as the groups to be able to have an active role, play an active role in the conservation of wildlife in the state of Utah. And we're proud to be a part of the program. We send the tags that we get through the program to the various banquets that we have throughout the state as well as the national convention that we have there in Salt Lake City. And the tags generate a lot of interest and a lot of support and garner a lot of enthusiasm from the folks that are attending the banquets, and would like to thank the board for allowing this program to continue. Thank you. You have any questions for me? Okay, thank you.
I'm Byron Bateman, the president of Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, and I just want to thank Eric and all the other conservation groups that Calvin, you mentioned that meeting we have in April when we all sit down as conservation groups, and all these projects are brought before us. We have the opportunity to, you know, to work together, to put the funding together to make these projects happen throughout the state. And it's also great to see all the transplants and stuff that we've been able to do the last couple of years. The division has really stepped up their efforts on transplants, studies that we're doing on stuff like that. That, you know, we got a moose study, we're having problems with our moose. And it's great to see and find out what's actually going on with our moose population and other things throughout the state. But like Eric mentioned, you know, and the director mentioned earlier in his comments today is what's going on in the state, but you see the large, huge animals that we're harvesting around the state. That's a part of a direct result of what this, you know, conservation permit money helps create in the state of Utah. We are known for the quality of our, you know, wildlife and stuff like that, but there's no other state in the western United States that's done the amount of work that we've done. I don't know what the number is now, but it's 1.1 million acres of habitat restoration has been done that this money's helped. And, it, you know, in partnership and matching that money, it's over, you know, $100 million plus dollars, and that's growing as we go on, stuff like that. So it's just a great opportunity that we have to work around the state with all the different regions within the state. And some of this money, you know, we get special permission to do other projects. Doesn't necessarily always go back to big game projects. We're doing some pheasant projects and things like that. But it helps with our recruitment for our youth and stuff like that around the state. So it's very important that we maintain, you know, this program with high integrity and everything else that we do with it, because, you know, it's come under attack over the years and stuff like that from other groups and stuff like that, because they really don't understand. And Bill's you know, PowerPoint they put out there today, I think that really gives a good explanation as to how the conservation permit program works. You know, Fred Morris was a great guy to step up to the plate the first time for $20,000 and buy that first sheep tag. And I know Utah Finaz has been, you know, one of the forefront people, you know, since that program with Fred Morris and stuff like that. So it is a great program. We're just glad to be a part of it, and we're glad that we've got great, you know, conservation, you know, partners here in the state to work with, along with the division and the board and everybody else. Thank you.
My name is Roy Hampton. I'm president of Utah Bowman's Association. We're a pretty small part in this project or in this program, but we'd like to thank you for letting us be a part of that. I can give you an example. When we started this program, we had $9,000 to spend when we come to the meeting. Now we're spending over $40,000 to $50,000. So we've really grown over it. It's made our banquet a better banquet. We only do one a year, and the tags are way up. What we try to do with our money was we try to divide it up into the five regions, so we're spending money in every region, so everybody can see that we're putting back not just into one area we want it to be into. So one thing that is critical, that the conservation project has come under attack, even in our little organization. I think it would be very informational if the division would post this on the web and give the people out there in the public, what is the conservation project? What is it about? Where's these funds go? Because the more, you know, information we have, the less we'll get under attack. Because, you know, our organization, as small as it is, thought Yuba is getting rich over this. And we're going to publish it in our newsletter exactly what we do. So there's no question of what it is. So, but I'd like to thank you again. I appreciate everything you've done for us. Thanks.
As a follow-up, I think you can find all this information on our web. I wish we were able to get more folks in there looking at it, but that's a good comment, and I think that's something that we'd heard and moved to a couple of years ago.
Yeah, this is Mike Canning with the Division of Wildlife. Just as a follow-up, the report that Bill Bates discussed, the annual report, that'll be available online. If you go to the appendix, there's a large table that lists by conservation group every penny that they spent and the project. And then you can go into our database that's available online to everybody, look at that project and see what occurred, see which group spent their money and how much they spent. So that's all available now. It's the first year we've done it. So we're trying to be much more transparent, and I hope that's really helpful to the public.
Okay, thanks to all of you. That was good. Okay, so moving right along then, let's move to approve the permit audit report. Bill. One more time.
I would make a motion that we approve the conservation permit audit.
I'll second that.
So motion by Mr. Fenimore and a second by Calvin Crandall. Any other discussion? All in favor? Motion carries unanimous. Number nine is conservation permit allocation 1 year. Mr. Bates.
I would be remiss not to mention that Mike Canning, he's really good with numbers and making sure that everything lines up. And he went through meticulously and made sure that every penny lined up this year, and I really appreciate his help with that, because I was out trying to get a muzzleloader deer and kind of slacking off here in the meantime, but I appreciate his help.
Slacking?
No, well, way. You know, once in a while, I got to do it.
Shouldn't tell your boss that.
What's that?
Shouldn't tell your boss that.
Uh-oh.
on record, no doubt.
Oh, man.
You're supposed to say, hey, I was out in the field double-checking, making sure everything was, you know, talking to some hunters, making sure everything was okay.
I talked to some hunters. I did.
There probably at least time credit for fishing and hunting activities.
So. Probably at least tens of people listening online, too.
Yeah. I'm sure. Especially to this part.
Did you get your deer?
No, but I had a great time. Saw a couple of mature bucks. What more can you ask for? It's just I'm pretty slow at getting that muzzle loader fired off. So, well, okay, I'm here to talk about the single year conservation permits, and I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, but real briefly, we had 26 permits available. We had two groups apply for them. We had issued 22 of the permits because that's all they asked for. We only had two permits where the two groups asked for the same permit. We received applications from Utah Bowman for Habitat and also from Ducks Unlimited. The two permits that were both requested was a buck deer permit in the Vernon, and that one went to Ducks Unlimited, and we had a bull elk permit on the Wasatch, and that one was awarded to Utah Bowman for Habitat. And as I explained in the other presentation, that was based on a combination of how much they felt that the permit was worth. They bid an amount, and then we adjusted that based on their performance from last year, and so it's just whichever group had the highest amount after that adjustment, and so that's how we awarded that. So anyway, we issued, we're recommending 18 be issued to Utah Bowman for Habitat and 4 to Ducks Unlimited, and you've got the table in front of you. So
how many was there?
We had 26 available. We're recommending that 22 be awarded. We did even send out a second call. We re-notified people we had 4 more permits left. And off the top of my head, I think those were just turkey permits. And we didn't have any takers. So, well, the reason is because we've gone to, you probably know.
Okay. Any other questions from Bill? Questions from the rack chairs? How about the audience? No comment cards.
Motion to accept this one-year plan for conservation permits.
Motion by Steve. Second by Calvin. All in favor? Motion carries unanimous. Okay. Guess we can skip item 10. Go to 11.
Can't skip 10. What's the matter with you?
Stacy.
Eric, you're not going to be here, huh?
You're up, Stacy. You said it was going to be gone by noon, too.
I know. Thanks for proving me wrong. Okay, I will make it very brief. It's just the 2015 RAC Wildlife Board meeting dates. In your packets, you had all of those listed out, so I won't go through each of those separately. Just a few things that are different this next year than have been in the past. And that is, we did switch the RAC order. So instead of starting down in the southern region, we will now start up north and do northern and central the first week. And then the southern tour will happen the second week of the RAC tour. So that is a change. The December board meeting for next year is scheduled to be on a Wednesday instead of a Thursday due to conflicts with this room. January board meetings, we had to move to Tuesdays to accommodate winter WAFWA. So that includes your upcoming January meeting. That would be on the Tuesday of that week instead of the Thursday. And then in 2016, it will also be on a Tuesday so that you that are going to winter WAFWA have time to fly out and do what you need to do. Couple other movements we made was a change in the brown bag, which doesn't really impact any of you. And then we moved a Northern Region RAC meeting for next December so that it wouldn't take place prior to the previous board meeting for their RAC, because it got all sorts of confusing. So we fixed that situation there, too. So I'm just looking to see if you guys want to add, you want to.
So is this basically the way you want it?
It is the way I want it. So I would assume it's also the way you want it.
Oh, question.
Yes.
What's in the brown bag?
The brown bag is where we get to sit around a table.
Oh, no, what's in the brown bag?
As a food? Nothing. Don't even get me started on that. That is an incredibly sore spot.
Anybody got any questions from Stacy?
Marshmallows?
There's not even marshmallows at the brown bag.
It's probably a good thing.
Yeah, we've been talking about this meeting to do some training and information on some of the fish plans and different things around the state in March, but I don't know we have a time. We'd invite the RAC chairs probably to that as well. So
okay.
I think we're looking at mid-March, but I don't know that we've got to wait till we get to the end of the legislature. So or
yeah.
Mid to late March.
Okay, I'm okay with all your proposed dates and everything. I've got them all memorized as you brought them forward. Just make sure to email and put out to the rest of them so they know what's going on.
And the meetings will still start at 9, Calvin.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Good enough. Thanks.
Central time, right?
Yeah, so 9:15, 9:20.
That traffic is.
Okay. Motion to approve by Bill Fenimore. Seconded by Mike. All in favor? Chickens. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Any other business by anybody? I have none, so motion to adjourn. Second. Oh, did you want to talk about that, Annie?
Well, we'll need a couple folks who want to go to that. It's in Las Vegas. This year.
Oh, Steve, nice. You're on. Vegas. I knew you'd want in.
What are the dates?
Don't matter.
Doesn't matter. It's in the winter. It's in Vegas. Steve's all over it.
Waffle.
January 8th through the 11th. It usually spans a weekend to try to keep people from. January 8th through 11th. So.
Okay, so you got one.
Yeah, huh?
Need another. I don't know if
Dr. My wife Woodward says I can't play John with Barron. Steve no more, so I'm out.
Maybe Kirk. Yeah, Kirk might be good. We'll see. Yeah, are you in class by then? Okay.
Okay, in your hands.
We'll find someone else to go.
Okay, so Mr. Fenimore made a motion to adjourn. We seconded by Calvin. All in favor? Thank you. Motion